67 degrees in Lawrence, 68 in Manhattan. The time is 3:06.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
Election Day is less than 2 weeks away, and no matter what happens on November 5th, Republicans and Democrats are preparing for a lengthy battle over the results. Already, there have been dozens and dozens of lawsuits filed that challenge how elections are run in this country, and many Americans have already voted. Here to walk us through what could happen next month and into the new year is Jessica Marsden, Director of Impact Programs for Free and Fair Elections at Protect Democracy. Jessica, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jessica, I just want to start with the fact that there are already a number of lawsuits and legal issues that have been filed, and we haven't even gotten to Election Day yet. What can you tell us about what we know about them? What kinds of themes are emerging?
Yeah, these last minute challenges hit on a few themes. One is we've seen a number of suits from the RNC and affiliated conservative organizations challenging voter eligibility, saying in essence that there are a number, thousands in some cases, of voters who are registered to vote who shouldn't be, whether that be because they are non-citizens or there's some other issue with their eligibility. Another category of cases I'd point to has to do with overseas voting. Just in the past few weeks, we've seen cases in North Carolina, Michigan, and Pennsylvania challenging those states' procedures for allowing overseas citizens, including members of the military, to participate this fall.
Help us unpack the Republican strategy here and why those types of lawsuits are coming now.
One strategy that may lay behind filing these lawsuits now goes back to 2020, where many of those cases were dismissed by courts because the cases were brought too late. You can't wait until after an election to challenge a voter's eligibility to cast his or her ballot. So it seems likely that by filing some of these cases now, even though they don't stand a chance of getting relief before the election, the RNC may be readying to make some of those same arguments after the election and hoping that the existence of these earlier suits somehow helps their cause then.
So we talked about some of the lawsuits that the Republican National Committee has filed, but what about the Democrats? What kind of suits have they brought?
In general, the Democrats have been bringing fewer cases than the Republicans this year. And often they are intervening in cases that were initially brought by Republicans. So you do end up, you know, with the two parties on opposite sides of a lawsuit. But one unusual thing this year is that I think we've seen more of these cases coming from Republican groups.
You know, I have to imagine that most voters, they don't follow the ins and outs of election and some of this litigation as closely as you and I do. But if they're hearing this conversation, they might be concerned if they've already cast a ballot or they're preparing to cast one. What would you say to people who might be feeling some of that anxiety around all of this?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in many states, you can actually follow up with your local election office and see, you know, if you've cast a mail-in ballot, was it counted? Was that ballot accepted? But in general, I just, you know, remind voters that if they are closely following the instructions from their election offices, their vote's going to count.
With being as close to Election Day as we are, and with the fact that this is a race by all projections, it's going to be quite close. What concerns you the most when you look at the landscape?
I think the fact that we have seen a close to a four-year campaign to really degrade trust in our election system, and that, you know, has led some voters to lose faith in the election process is probably my biggest concern. I'd encourage folks with questions about the trustworthiness of our election process to spend some time, you know, on the website of your local election office. You know, there are a number of really excellent election officials who are putting out good information that will walk folks through the process of how their vote gets cast and counted. That kind of information, I hope, can start to dispel some of the fear and anxiety that voters may have about this process.
That was Jessica Marsden, lawyer and director of Impact Programs for Free and Fair Elections at Protect Democracy. Jessica, thank you.
Thanks so much.
This is the 385th day of war in Gaza. For people there, it's death, not life, that feels certain. NPR correspondent Aya Betraoui and producer Anas Baba report on how Israeli military operations against Hamas are intensifying.
This week, some 20,000 people streamed out of the town of Jabalia in North Gaza, traumatized and exhausted, ordered by lethal drones hovering in the sky to leave their homes after 3 weeks under siege. Amir Saleh was one of them. He tells NPR over the phone how families like his walked more than 2 miles south to Gaza City, past wounded people who couldn't be carried. Along the way, Saleh walked past Jabalia's Indonesian hospital, besieged by an Israeli tank. He says people in the hospital cried out, "Water, water." But he says no one could help. The army fired on anyone who tried. Inside that hospital, a nurse sent this voice memo heard by NPR.
The situation is very, very, very bad.
The nurse, whose name we're not publishing for his safety, says the military has been ordering hospital staff to leave, but they refuse to abandon the patients.
I feel fatigue and nausea and dizziness. I didn't eat from yesterday.
Outside, Saleh was separated from his wife and kids. He says all males over 13 years old were taken by Israeli soldiers and ordered to sit in a dirt hole. Then, in groups of four, they were told to face cameras for scans. Tanks flanked them. Some were detained. Saleh was among those released hours later. Gaza civil defense say also at least 500 people, including doctors and aid workers, have been killed in the siege, but that many are still trapped under the rubble. Israel's military says its operation in Jabalia has killed and detained hundreds of Hamas militants trying to regroup and uncovered rocket launchers. Here's Israeli government spokesman David Mentzer.
These are heartbreaking images of civilians on the move. Again, we understand that fact, but of course it's much better to get them out of harm's way.
For Saleh, there is nowhere in Gaza that is out of harm's way. He's tried evacuating before, but says while he was sheltering in a hospital in December, Israeli tank fire killed his 3-year-old son Karim while he was cradling him. Saleh says during this current siege, he told his wife, "I wish death for us all together, so none of us has to mourn the other." But it's not just the north. All of Gaza has become a kill zone. In the middle and south, people despair. Another Israeli airstrike on a school sheltering displaced families killed 18 people, 11 of them children, on Thursday in central Gaza. Israel says it was targeting a Hamas figure inside. A teenage boy cries over the body of his niece, just 9. Bara Alfar says Jenna had left the north only 6 days ago after facing starvation there for this. Starve or leave, that's what some in Israel say they want. At a rally in Israel near Gaza's border this week, settlers and senior government officials called for Palestinians to be expelled from Gaza to make way for Jewish settlements. They're hopeful the military's operations could make that happen. Aya Batraoui, NPR News Dubai, with reporting by Anas Baba in Gaza.
The New York Yankees and Los Angeles Dodgers are facing off in the World Series. Yes, big hitters brought them there.
Aaron Judge finally connects his first home run of this postseason.
There's a drive. It's a bullet. Was there any doubt? Shohei Ohtani.
But so did a passion for the game. And as sports fans know, fandom is often something you inherit. It gets passed down from generation to generation.
That's the case for two current players on the Yankees, shortstop Anthony Volpe and pitcher Gerrit Cole.
Earlier this week, Volpe's dad shared a picture on Instagram of young Anthony Volpe at the 2009 Yankees Victory Parade in Manhattan.
That was the last time the team won a championship. Now the 23-year-old is considered one of the best young talents in the sport.
Here's how announcers described the hometown kid in his first major league game in the Bronx last season.
Anthony didn't just want to play Major League Baseball. He wanted to play shortstop for the New York Yankees. Born in Manhattan, wanted to be the next Derek Jeter. Was that the last World Series parade? Is that the All-Star game here in 14? Fulfilling his dream. Opening day shortstop of the Yankees, Anthony Volpe.
Volpe jokes that he didn't really have much of a choice when it came to picking a team. The Yankees lineage in his family dates back to his great-grandfather. Here's Volpe after his team clinched a spot in the World Series.
I always dream, but this doesn't even do it justice. You always dream of going to the World Series and playing games like this, but to be on a team like this with the guys and how close you are, it's a family, and that's what makes it better.
His teammate, Gerrit Cole, on the other hand, rooted for the team from the other side of the country in Southern California. When Cole signed his contract for the Yankees in 2019, Cole took a childhood memento to his introductory press conference.
It was a sign he'd held up in the ballpark as a kid that read, Yankee fan, today, tomorrow, forever.
I just love the Yankees. My dad was a Yankee fan, and he just introduced me to the Yankees. It was just hard not to love Derek Jeter and the crew, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s. I mean, it's kind of like, how can you not be a Lakers fan in Southern California when Kobe and Shaq were doing their thing?
It seems fitting that the former captain, Derek Jeter, inspired two young kids 3,000 miles apart to grow up and bring the Yankees back to the World Series.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 91.3 FM in Junction City, always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from the University of Kansas Libraries, a state, regional, and federal depository providing the resources and partnerships necessary for both research and academic success. More at lib.ku.edu.
Stay tuned. Coming up in our next half hour, Laura Marling has a new album out. We are going to learn more about it. Also in the next 30 minutes, World Series is getting underway. Becky Sullivan has a report. We, of course, will have news headlines. I have some regional things to tell you about. It's all coming up on KPR. Never fear, we will get back to live day music beginning at 7 o'clock tonight, immediately following All Things Considered on your KPR One stations.
This month's KPR Community Spotlight is on Cherry Street Youth in Chanute, an after-school program for kindergarten through fifth grade students, welcoming volunteers for special projects, reading to the children, or to share a talent or skill. Details on how to get involved at cherrystreet.org.
Mostly clear skies tonight. A pleasant change from last night. Lows in the mid-30s. Not that we didn't need the rain. It just freaked a lot of people out, including me and my dog. Tomorrow, sunshine. Highs in the mid-60s. Lows in the lower 40s tomorrow night. In the mid-70s for Sunday. Mostly clear Sunday night with lows in the upper 50s. Warm again on Monday. These roller coaster temperatures. Highs in the mid to upper 80s. Right now, 67 degrees in Topeka, 69 in Emporia. It is 3:20.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. And from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose mission is to assess practitioner competency to create design solutions that safeguard public health, safety, and welfare. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. In a presidential race that's neck and neck, the Washington Post is staying out of it. The newspaper with the motto, Democracy Dies in Darkness, is not endorsing any candidate for the White House for the first time in a general election since 1988. NPR's David Folkenflik broke the story and joins us now. Hi, David.
Hey, Juana.
So, David, here's the big question. Why? What do we know about why the Post is not endorsing a presidential candidate this year?
Well, I can go first to what the Post's publisher and CEO Will Lewis has to say. He says they're returning to the Post's roots as an independent paper. That's one of its mottos. It says it's going to back to a time many decades ago when they didn't endorse presidential candidates. They don't want to tell their readers what to think. They want to equip them with what to think. Mm-hmm. And I got to tell you, there is an effort right now to kind of address the concerns of, you know, record low level of trust in the media, and particularly on the conservative side, particularly among people supportive of President Trump. But this is not something that's doing a whole lot of to build up trust and support inside the Post newsroom right now. There's been a series of outcries, really, in the reaction there.
Okay, so you've mentioned the outcries inside the newsroom. I'm curious, just broadly, can you sweep up some of the reaction? What have you been hearing from your sources?
Well, so editor-at-large Robert Kagan has been a columnist there for years. He told me and other news outlets that he had resigned from the editorial board as a result. This was a decision that basically came after the editorial page editor had approved in principle an endorsement of Kamala Harris, Vice President Harris, for the presidency, and that Jeff Bezos, the owner of the Post, basically said, we're not going to be doing that this year. Well, this has also resulted in a lot of tumult. Other people are considering resignations. There's anger inside the newsroom because this is an outlet that has repeatedly, in its reporting, reported on improprieties and, in fact, alleged illegalities by former President Trump while he was in office and his associates, and said he was unfit for service on its separately run editorial page. In addition, I've seen internal correspondence at the Post that shows that already at least 1,600 people have canceled their digital subscriptions. That's far outstrips their usual pace and suggests real anger on behalf of some of their readership.
David, I got to tell you, some of this sounds a little familiar. When we talked yesterday on the show, we were talking about a similar decision by the owner of the Los Angeles Times. So now in a matter of days, there are two major newspapers, one on each coast, saying they're not weighing in. They don't want to pick between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump in this year's presidential election. Obviously, two different papers. But how should we read these decisions that are at the very top of these massive influential media outlets?
Well, in general, I would say that the kindest way of saying it is that major news organizations have been struggling in the age of social media and in the age of certain kinds of social justice movements to reassert the idea that these conventional big news outlets are independent of any partisan slant, of any ideological taint. And at the same time, you have both of them are owned by billionaires and billionaires with major financial interests. In the case of Patrick Soon-Shiong, the owner of the Los Angeles Times, he's a medical inventor who has a ton of patents and other issues in front of federal regulators. You've got Jeff Bezos, of course, the founder of Amazon. He owns the Washington Post, but he also Amazon has a lot of issues in front of the federal government. It's the postal charges it incurs for its shipping, the question of its cloud computing services for the Department of Defense, and what he does with Blue Origin, his space company with NASA, that's worth billions of dollars, too. As Trump has repeatedly threatened retribution against media outlets that he claims has wronged him, as we talked about yesterday, you're seeing news outlets shy away from punching hard at the president at this moment.
That's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thank you.
You bet.
Okay, we turn now to a rare instance of public disagreement from within the U.S. Justice Department. DOJ lawyers sent a letter this week to Attorney General Merrick Garland, and the letter calls out what it describes as the, quote, glaring gap between the department's aggressive approach prosecuting crimes committed by Russia and Hamas versus the department's silence on potential crimes committed by Israel. NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas has obtained the letter and joins us now. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there.
Okay, so before we get into more of what the letter says, what can you tell us about who exactly wrote this letter?
So it's a four-page letter. It was sent out this week. It was first reported by the online outlet Zatteo. The letter itself is signed anonymously as your colleagues, but I've confirmed through my own reporting that it was written by three Justice Department attorneys. These are mid-career folks. Two of them work at DOJ headquarters here in Washington. Two of the authors told me that the Israel-Gaza conflict isn't something that's really discussed at work. It's, of course, a politically charged issue. And so the authors considered sending this letter around for signatures, but they have concerns about potential professional blowback for speaking out on this topic. So instead, what they did is write the letter and send it anonymously to the Attorney General. Now, it's important to say here that there are around 10,000 attorneys who work at the Justice Department.
Mm-hmm.
This was written by three, so this is a very, very, very small sample.
Yeah.
And it's unclear how widespread the views that are expressed in the letter are at the wider department.
Okay. Well, let's talk more about the letter. What does it say?
Well, the letter points out that Attorney General Merrick Garland has frequently talked about the importance of norms, of treating like cases alike, the idea that the department investigates and prosecutes crimes with political considerations.
Mm-hmm.
That, in fact, was even the theme of a big speech that Garland gave last month to the DOJ workforce. But the letter says that when it comes to potential crimes by Israel, the department under Garland's leadership isn't living up to that. It says that despite credible evidence that Israeli forces have violated U.S. law, the department hasn't taken any public steps to hold perpetrators to account, even when the victims are U.S. citizens. And it also says that stands in stark contrast to the Justice Department's very public, very aggressive approach to possible Russian war crimes in Ukraine and Hamas's crimes in its October 7th attack on Israel. To be clear, the letter welcomes the department's tough approach on Russia and Hamas. What the letter is criticizing is the corresponding silence and apparent lack of action regarding potential crimes by Israelis.
So interesting. Well, Ryan, you've reported on the department's approach to both the Russia-Ukraine conflict and the Israel-Hamas conflict. What have you found?
Well, what my reporting has shown is this. After Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, the Attorney General publicly condemned what he called Russia's war crimes. He set up a special team at the department to focus on investigating Russian atrocities. And the department has charged four Russian soldiers so far with war crimes in Ukraine.
Okay.
On the conflict in Gaza, Garland has publicly confirmed the department is investigating Hamas's killing of some 40 Americans, as well as the kidnapping of some in the attack on Israel. And the department has brought terrorism charges against six Hamas leaders.
All right. Well, how does that differ from the department's approach to possible crimes by Israeli forces or Israeli civilians?
The Attorney General has said nothing in public about examining possible Israeli war crimes in Gaza. Israel, for its part, says that it obeys the laws of war. But many legal experts, many legal experts say that under the Israel's actions could amount to war crimes, some of them at least, including under U.S. law. There are also four American citizens who have been killed in the West Bank and Gaza this year, their families saved by Israeli soldiers or civilians. We here at NPR have reported on those killings. We've spoken with all four families. They told us they've heard nothing from the Justice Department. Garland has said nothing in public about investigating those killings. The department has declined to comment about any of these issues, including the letter. That silence has helped fuel the questions raised in the letter about whether the department in these particular matters is taking politics into consideration in its decision making.
That is NPR's Ryan Lucas. Thank you so much, Ryan.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Polls are open across the country. Election day is just over a week away, and swing states are hotly contested. Voters there feel it.
I need to feel comfortable. That is the only strategy at this state.
We take you to Georgia and the bullseye of campaign 2024. That and news from all around the world, Saturday and weekend edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning beginning at 7 o'clock on your KPR station, 7 to 10 a.m. We bring you Weekend Edition Saturday with Scott Simon and Kay McIntyre.
Support for KPR comes from Delta Dental of Kansas, reminding listeners that dental checkups can help identify health conditions like heart disease, diabetes, and more. Dentists can be found at deltadentalks.com/find.
Stay tuned. News headlines are up next. It is 66 degrees in Atchison, 71 in Chanute. It is 3:30.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. There's a new bronze statue on the National Mall, and it's not a founding father.
No, it's a piece of poop meant to take aim at January 6th.
That's what art is supposed to do. Art is supposed to encourage people to think about things, and sometimes it is meant to shock people.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. President Biden gave an emotional apology to the Native American community today for how the government treated them in the past. Speaking at the Gila Indian River Indian Reservation, where government-run boarding schools separated children from their parents, as part of a forced assimilation program, wiping out identities, languages, and culture in the process. Biden called it a blot on American history.
After 150 years, the United States government eventually stopped the program. But the federal government has never, never formally apologized for what happened until today. I formally apologize as President of the United States of America for what we did. I formally apologize.
Democrats are hoping the visit also provides a boost to the Harris campaign's turnout effort in another key battleground state. More than 32 million voters have cast their ballots as part of early voting in next month's general election. But as NPR's Hansi Luong tells us, time is running out for eligible voters to get registered in some states.
If you're eligible but haven't signed up yet in Nebraska, today is the last chance to register to vote in this fall's election. Eligible Nebraskans can stop by their county election office, or if they happen to be applying for or renewing their driver's license today, sign up in person at the Department of Motor Vehicles. If you're already registered, you may want to check your registration status soon. Voters can sometimes fall off a registration list or need to update the information if they moved, changed their name, or haven't voted in a while. Eligible voters still have time to sign up in person or online in Massachusetts and New York, but those registration windows close on Saturday. The Postal Service is urging all mail-in voters to return their ballots at least 1 week before their state's deadlines. Hansi Luong, NPR News.
This is NPR.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Laura Lorson with your regional headlines. Powerful storms rolled across northeast Kansas and western Missouri last night, knocking out power to as many as 17,000 customers of Evergy. The utility company says 4,000 homes in the Topeka area lost power. Another 500 homes lost power in Jefferson County. The cities of Hays and Russell are suing nearby Edwards County for attempts to slow down a water transfer project. The cities say a lack of water due to drought and low groundwater available is a threat to their residents. 30 years ago, the cities purchased a ranch in Edwards County to draw groundwater for the municipalities. Since then, the city manager for Hays, Toby Doherty, says it's been years of regulatory hurdles.
There are people in Edwards County that don't like seeing that water leave their area. Well, that water leaves their area every day in corn and cattle and hogs and dairies.
An attorney for Edwards County says he's still reviewing the lawsuit. Dr. Roy Menninger, the grandson of the man who found the Menninger Clinic, has died at the age of 97. Roy was the former CEO of the Menninger Foundation and served as chair of the foundation's board of trustees until 2003, when the Menninger Clinic moved to Baylor. Along with his wife, Bev, Menninger served as co-chair of the KPR advisory board for many years. The family is suggesting memorial donations to Doctors Without Borders in lieu of flowers. Kansas wildlife officials hope to block an invasive carp from moving upstream of a dam in Lawrence. The Bowersock Dam on the Kansas River is a relatively low one, and silver carp are excellent jumpers. When the river is high, they could leap over the hydroelectric dam. So the Kansas Department of Wildlife and Parks is planning to install a kind of grate. Liam Odell is a biologist with the agency.
The way I can describe it is it'll kind of be like these metal fingers will come off of that north powerhouse where we're worried about them potentially jumping over. And those will prevent them from being able to get that, achieve enough height to go into the other side.
Wildlife officials want to block this species because it's a prolific spawner that grows fast and competes with native fish for food. You're listening to KPR. It's 3:35.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is only in theaters this Thursday. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro.
The British singer-songwriter Laura Marling signed her first record deal when she was 16 years old, and she knew even then that she wanted to approach the music industry on her terms. Here's what she told a guest host of NPR's Morning Edition way back in 2008.
What's that meeting like where you tell Virgin Records, actually, no, I'm not going to have my photo on the album jacket?
If they ever tried to make me do anything like that, I would down tools.
Is that a British expression? I'm not familiar with it.
Down tools, stop working. I put the guitar down. Music, the music industry is whatever you want it to be. If you want to be mega famous, you're going to have to do things that people tell you. Until you get mega famous, and then you can tell everybody what to do.
Well, now Laura Marling is an established artist who has won a raft of awards, and she has just released her eighth album, Patterns in Repeat. Laura Marling, it is good to talk to you again some 16 years after our last chat.
Wow, I can't believe that. Thank you for having me again.
It's really nice to have you back. You had such a clear vision, even as a teenager, of how you wanted to relate to the music industry, how you wanted to shape your career. How has that vision evolved as you have grown into the established adult artist you are today?
Well, I think it's much the same. I mean, I was surprised to hear myself say that. I don't remember obviously saying that, but I still very much live by that sort of philosophy. And I never have changed since then, it sounds like. I've always just...
I love that you're surprised by that, that it's not like a slogan that is hung on your wall through every record and every interview you've ever done, that like this is your true north.
No, it's not. I mean, I think it's part of my obstinate nature. I think, you know, like a contrarian nature, maybe.
Well, on this latest album, Patterns in Repeat, your new role as a parent figures prominently. At the very top, one of the first sounds we hear is your baby leading into the song Child of Mine.
You and your dad are dancing in the kitchen. Life is slowing down, but it's still pushing.
Can you paint a picture for us of the scene that you are giving us access to here?
So I recorded this album when my daughter was 4 months old, which in retrospect was very smart, because after they can start walking, you really are limited in what you can do. But before that, you know, they sort of sleep or sit on the floor, or, you know. So basically I turned my living room into a recording studio and had her in the room for the entire recording process and just stole moments where I could to record. So there's a lot of sort of incidental homely noise on the album that became quite an important sort of character.
And in this first song especially, I think there are lyrics that feel universal to the experience of being a parent and very elemental.
Last night in your sleep you started crying. I can't protect you there though I keep trying.
That was the first song I wrote after she was born, which I hadn't been expecting to have any interest in writing. I'd like very much prepared for not having any interest in writing for years. But of course, what I didn't understand or foresee is that the experience of becoming a parent really cracks you open to a new level of truly terrifying love.
Your father wrote one of the songs on this album, right?
Yes, he did. There's a song on the album called Looking Back.
Today with age, my body is bent, and against my will, I must relent.
My father was a songwriter in the 70s, so I knew it. I'd always thought it was a really good song, and then he played it just sort of when he was here visiting after my daughter was born, and it just like, it floored me, the new relevance that it had to the album that I was putting together. Because it's written from the perspective of an old man looking back over his life and wondering whether his love was well spent.
How did he react when he heard your version of it for the first time?
He actually hasn't.
What?
He hasn't heard it yet. Yeah, he'll hear it when the album comes out. I mean,
no.
I suppose it might, yeah.
Why are you keeping it from him?
I don't know. Again, something to be investigated, some weird sort of crooked
part. Are you going to like sit him down and, you know, close the window shades and turn the lights low and play it? Or are you just going to let him download the album on his streaming platform and listen to it whenever he does.
I think probably the latter. Yeah, I think I'm trying to avoid.
I shouldn't judge, but that seems so odd to me.
Welcome to my universe. But you know, yeah, it's a sort of too embarrassing to confront him with it face to face.
What do you think that means to him to have that song he wrote on this album?
He's a bit like me. He's sort of embarrassed by too much attention at once. But I think it will mean, I don't know. You love to know what your parents actually feel and think. They're kind of a mystery to me in the best way.
One could ask.
Yes, but that would be too straightforward. I can't cope with that.
You wrote the title track of this album, Patterns and Repeat, when you, your partner, and your baby were in Paris for a funeral, and it was the first time you had ever taken your daughter to a hotel, so people can imagine all of the chaos that that entails.
Yeah.
And there's this line.
I want you to know that I gave it up willingly.
I want you to know that I gave it up willingly.
Nothing real was lost in the bringing of you to me.
Nothing real was lost in the bringing of you to me. Will you tell us about what that means to you? And whether it's true?
Yeah, oh, it's certainly true. The funeral that we were attending was, it was an extraordinary example of what it is to give everything to your children. You know, earlier I was saying, wouldn't it be great to understand the desires and inner workings of your parents? And in a way, it's part of the process that you don't know that, because it's for your benefit that their passions and desires are subjugated in your honor. And there's something profoundly healing about understanding that as you become a parent, and also something to be incredibly proud of.
Do you think about your daughter someday using your songs, these lyrics, this album and others, to understand you in a way that you talk about wanting to or wishing you could understand your own parents?
Maybe. Like, a big part of my early life was finding it very difficult to express myself, you know, straightforwardly, and there may have been suggestions of that still being a problem in my life in this very interview, but in some ways that is a problem. But where I have never struggled to say something in terms of what I want to get across is in songwriting. So I hope it serves as that, if not just for my daughter, for people in general.
Well, Laura Marling, it has been such a pleasure talking to you again after all of these years. Thank you for the conversation.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed speaking with you again.
Her new album is Patterns in Repeat.
And as those years go by, they'll look upon you kindly.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
New York versus Los Angeles, Yankees versus Dodgers, Aaron Judge versus Shohei Ohtani. The World Series begins tonight, and it is the most hyped World Series in a generation. And here to hype me is NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan. Hey, Becky.
Elsa.
Okay, this is not going to be impartial journalism right now, because, of course, I am going to be rooting for the LA Dodgers, my home team. LA is going nuts this week. Help us understand.
Yes. Yeah,
Becky,
I mean,
this World Series is such a big deal.
Totally. It's a juggernaut of a matchup. This is like a Goliath versus Goliath situation. It's actually been sort of rare in baseball to have the two best teams face off in the World Series lately. But we're undeniably getting that this year, no matter what way you look at it. So these two teams had the best records in their respective leagues. They had the two best players, the likely MVPs, and Judge and Ohtani, as you mentioned, and certainly just two of baseball's, you know, like, just most storied franchises. A rivalry that dates back like 100 years.
Yeah, when the Dodgers were still in New York, right? The Brooklyn Dodgers.
Exactly, yeah. So this was like a crosstown rivalry. You had players like Joe DiMaggio, Jackie Robinson, Sandy Koufax, Mickey Mantle. I mean, like,
wow.
It's nuts. So the Dodgers and the Yankees had met 11 times in the World Series. This will be the 12th. That's a record. And then somehow, despite the pedigrees, we actually haven't seen the Yankees win a title since 2009. And then the Dodgers, their only title since the 80s was the 2020 season, which was shortened by the pandemic and sort of is seen in the baseball world as having a little bit of an asterisk.
Okay, so according to you, this is going to be hugely exciting,
But do all baseball fans agree?
Oh, well, I mean, there's always going to be the haters. And so maybe for you, I can put like a little hater hat on, play a little pretend.
Let me see that hat.
Say you grew up with a small market team like the Kansas City Royals. My team has been to the playoffs only 3 times in my entire life. So imagine those long-suffering Los Angeles Dodgers fans, 12 postseason appearances in a row. Three-year-olds in Los Angeles also have had their team in the playoffs as many times as I have. So then the Yankees, no title since 2009. I hope that they are crying themselves to sleep on a pile of those 27 World Series trophies they have. So these are two of the richest payrolls in baseball, according to SpotTrack, which is this like service that tracks sports financials. Uh-huh. The Yankees and the Dodgers rosters this year combined to cost more than the cheapest 6 entire teams in baseball. So of course they can afford great players. So now they're in the World Series. Your perspective, personally, I'm jazzed.
Okay, but there must be something even a hater can enjoy.
Of course,
this,
yeah.
Right?
You're going to be watching the two best players in baseball today. Shohei Ohtani, the Japanese-born player who came to the U.S. for the 2018 season. He's amazing both at pitching and batting. This is his first postseason appearance. This season, he's been recovering from surgery to his pitching elbow, so he's only been batting, but still his season has been unbelievable. He became the first player ever to hit more than 50 home runs and steal more than 50 bases in the same regular season, and somehow has been even more impressive in the postseason.
That's my man. Okay, what about the Yankees star?
Yeah. Well, so that's Aaron Judge. This season, he posted just like a history book level batting season, 58 home runs in the regular season. He hasn't been quite as dominant in the postseason yet. People are hoping that he'll break out now that he's here, but he is almost certainly going to win the American League MVP, as Ohtani will in the National League. And the fact that these two guys are household names is just like a real change of pace for baseball, which has struggled to market its stars in the past. So it is like a dream for league officials and for fans to have them meet on the sport's biggest stage. I think this World Series, Yankees-Dodgers, Ohtani versus Judge, is going to show us the absolute ceiling for Major League Baseball right now.
Woohoo! That is NPR's Becky Sullivan. Thank you, Becky.
You're welcome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join me, Nick Carswell, this Saturday at 5 p.m. for 105 Live, where we continue our quest to bring you the best new, original, and noteworthy music being made all across the state of Kansas. This week's show includes artists from Wichita, Manhattan, Lawrence, and Kansas City, and our live session comes from the stage of the Bottleneck with Eddie Moore's Electric Group. That's 105 Live this Saturday at 5 p.m. on Kansas Public Radio.
This is your place for NPR News from the University of Kansas, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 96.1 FM in Lawrence as well. Many other frequencies also, and always streaming at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from the Bert Nash Center, reminding listeners that it's okay to not be okay. Information about taking the first step to address stress, anxiety, and depression is at 785-843-9192 or bertnash.org.
Stay with us. Coming up in our next half hour, an update of news headlines. Then in Pittsburgh, PA, taxes are one reason a small business owner says he is voting for Vice President Kamala Harris.
It's very easy to accommodate this new enormous...
Okay, that is not what they told me it would be, but trust me, the small business owner was going long on Vice President Kamala Harris's willingness to tax the upper classes. You will hear the audio coming up here on KPR. Stick around.
Support for KPR comes from Woodhaven, Inc., manufacturing custom deck and siding solutions using sustainable woods and powered exclusively by wind energy. Located in Perry, with shipping available to the entire KPR listening area. Details at woodhavenproducts.com.
Mostly clear skies tonight, lows in the mid-30s. Hey, it's live radio. Sunshine tomorrow, highs in the mid-60s. It's 10 minutes before 4.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Growing up, Olivia Kwan's mom, Basha, used to take her out into the cul-de-sac to play football. Two-hand touch football. It felt normal to Kwan. She'd grown up hearing her mom's stories of playing professional football with the Houston Hurricanes.
And it wasn't until quite a bit later
in life when I started to really put the pieces together that not everyone's mom played football. In fact, very few people's moms played football.
Not only that, Juan says, kids at school didn't believe her that her mom played football. They, like a lot of people, believed pro football was just for men.
That, you know, was the early onset of the frustration about the perception of women in football for me.
Now, Olivia Kwan has turned that childhood frustration into action. A documentary called The Hurricanes, all about the Houston Hurricanes and the National Women's Football League of the 1970s.
Yeah, the league was started by a fella named Sid Friedman, and he kind of thought that the whole thing would be a bit of a spectacle, kind of like a circus act, maybe similar to the Harlem Globetrotters. And some tension formed between Sid and his vision and the women who showed up to play. They wanted to play real football, real tackle football, and he wanted something different. So the players quickly spun away from Sid Friedman, and eventually the actual NWFL was formed in 1974. 2 years after that was pretty much the height of the NWFL, and at that point it was about 14 teams strong, and they were clusters of teams in the Ohio area, which included Pennsylvania and Michigan, and there was a cluster in California, and then there was at last the cluster in the South, which included Texas and Oklahoma.
I have to say, I am a person that absolutely loves football, and I clock more hours than I will admit right now watching NFL games on Sundays, and even given all of that, this part of football history is one that I didn't know a whole lot about myself, even given the current spotlight that there is on women's sports. So I wonder for you, why do you think it is that the National Women's Football League's history isn't well known?
Well, don't worry, you're not alone. It comes down to the fact that these women were not accepted in the 1970s. It was really difficult to get media attention. It was really difficult to get butts in the seats. They did have a bit more attention on them in smaller municipalities such as Tulsa, Oklahoma City, but in a big city like Houston, the Houston Hurricanes were really struggling to get any attention when they were competing with the Houston Oilers or other professional men's sports.
I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about the story of the Hurricanes in your documentary. Even despite that early rocky start, the Hurricanes, they kept going, the league keeps going, and the team and its players, they get better despite a really stunning lack of resources. Throughout the course of the documentary, we get to hear some of the incredible personal stories that these players told you about the team, what it meant to play. I wonder, is there one that sticks out in your memory that you could share with us?
Yeah, my mom has always really valued her football playing experience. But when I started talking to the other players of the Houston Hurricanes, it was very clear that to some of them, this was one of the most impactful experiences of their entire life. There was one woman who told me that this was where she found real love and had a sistership with her teammates that cannot be found anywhere else in her life.
I would look forward to go to practice. I would look forward to go play that game. I would look forward to go to that club after that game. I would look forward to be with my sisters.
There's definitely a few women who talked about how they really needed to push themselves physically and how that created this determination within them that they carried all the way through their life today.
It was special just having a group of women that wanted to play football and were willing to go out there and hit and get dirty and sweat and not to be afraid to say they were strong.
And that's really one of the things that I think is the most powerful message about the women's sports movement in general. If we empower girls and women to participate in sports, it opens them up to leadership positions that they may not have been able to pursue otherwise. It's something that everyone can gain from.
Olivia, this is a story about sports, but it's also a family story. You excavated all of these memories and dug into all of this history that forms the documentary with your mom, who, of course, had the firsthand experience. I wonder, did going through the years-long process of putting together this documentary, did it all help you come to know your mother and her story differently?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that was really nice about doing this project is that in the beginning, it was just me and her working on it together. It really helped transform our relationship into a place where it was less mother and child and a little bit more eye to eye. As far as perception is concerned, I always have remembered her as being a very strong woman. And this has, if anything, only reinforced that.
We've been speaking with Olivia Kwan, director of The Hurricanes. The film opens in Houston first, then across the country throughout the fall. Olivia, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
A new statue erected on the National Mall is causing quite a stir. The statue depicts a bronze swirled poop on top of a recreation of Nancy Pelosi's desk. And below it is a plaque that reads in part, "This memorial honors the brave men and women who broke into the United States Capitol on January 6, 2021 to loot, urinate, and defecate throughout those hallowed halls in order to overturn an election." NPR's Mia Venkat went out to the statue today to hear what people had to say about it.
Workers are mowing the lawn as I walk up to the group of people gathered around the statue taking photos and selfies with it. There's someone in a Harris Walls camo hat. Some people stop by while on a run. Several others are in suits. People bend down to read the plaque.
My reaction when I found out about it was obviously that it was funny.
Kristen Hartke lives in New York now, but lived in D.C. at the time of the insurrection, just a couple blocks from the Capitol. She's also a trained artist, and she hopes the meaning of the statue doesn't get misinterpreted.
I think I would interpret the message as being pretty facetious, and clearly that visual that they have with this piece of art is showcasing that.
Well, at first, I was just told it was a poo statue, but actually after reading what it's about, I think it takes us back to the gravity of that day, and it takes us back to who do we want to be as a nation.
Anu Mandapati is from Austin, Texas, in town visiting a friend who took her to see the statue, whereas Jeff Parcells Johnson lives in Alexandria, Virginia. He biked over to see if the statue was actually real.
I think it's just a great juxtaposition to what Trump thinks this was, and it's funny. It's worthwhile to laugh at that sometimes.
According to the permit for the anonymous artwork, approved by the National Park Service, it will be on display until October 30th. We reached out to the person who requested the permit and have not yet heard back. And as I left the mall, massive sprinklers start up, soaking a few onlookers trying to get the perfect shot of the bronze poop. Mia Venkat, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at amazonbusiness.com. From Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
I'm Dual Face Sloan, in for Peter Sagal. On this week's Wait Wait, canceling plans is easier than ever, and we spend time with Sue Bird and Megan Rapinoe. Join us for the news quiz from NPR.
Join us tomorrow morning, beginning at 10 o'clock on your KPR 1 stations for Wait Wait, Don't Tell Me, the weekly NPR news quiz. We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Listen on the web at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio. We are expecting a low in the mid-30s tonight. The time is 4 o'clock.
Choose in this race between someone who has been faithful to the Constitution, who will be faithful, and Donald Trump.
Former Congresswoman Liz Cheney and other Republicans urge members of their party to vote for Vice President Harris.
For Friday, October 25th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Our series, We the Voters, continues in North Carolina, which has more rural voters than any other swing state.
There's a lot of people want to stay out the way. They see the Trump signs. They see what's going on in school board, city council. They're just like, I'm going to stay out of it.
Also, the president of the union that represents WNBA players on why they deserve higher wages and more benefits after a historic season.
What the public is feeling and seeing is something that we've always known. And this new era is just us realizing that people see us for what we are.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Biden, for the first time as president, visited an Indian reservation in Arizona today, Biden issuing a historic apology for the federal Indian boarding school program. NPR's Jimena Bustillo has more.
Biden's formal apology addressed a history of forced cultural assimilation.
I formally apologize as president of the United States of America for what we did.
For over 150 years, Biden said that the U.S. underwent a horrific chapter during which Native American children were forced to undergo abuse and the erasure of their language. At least 900 children died, and the Interior Department estimates that the number of victims is even higher. Biden's visit comes less than 2 weeks before Election Day. The formal apology took place on the Gila River Crossing Community School grounds. The Gila River Indian community sits in part in Maricopa County, one of the counties that could determine control of the White House. Jimena Bustillo, NPR News, Phoenix.
A federal judge has ruled Virginia restore hundreds of previously canceled voter registrations, claiming the action was an illegal effort to stop non-citizens from voting. VPM News' John Khalil reports.
The National Voter Registration Act largely prevents people from being removed from voter rolls in the 90 days before a federal election. It's known as a quiet period and is meant to prevent elections officials from mistakenly removing eligible voters. Back in August, Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin had instituted new processes around voterless maintenance in an executive order. Youngkin raised the prospect that non-citizens might vote otherwise. But there is little evidence that's a problem. Virginia court records from the past 20 years don't show any prosecutions for non-citizens voting. The Department of Justice and a coalition of civic groups sued, saying the order violated the so-called quiet period. Voters in Alabama were also restored to the rolls after the DOJ sued under the same law. For NPR News, I'm Jad Khalil in Richmond.
The Washington Post has become the second major paper joining the LA Times in announcing it will not be endorsing a candidate in this year's presidential race. Post also says it won't be doing so in the future. It marks a major break in tradition for the paper, which for 36 years has made presidential endorsements. Decision was not to endorse a candidate was made by the Post billionaire owner Jeff Bezos. New orders for long-lasting manufactured products fell last month. Here's NPR Scott Horsley.
Orders for durable goods fell by 0.8% last month, weighed down by a sharp drop in orders for civilian aircraft. Excluding transportation, durable goods orders were up. McDonald's has identified a California onion supplier as the possible source of an E. coli outbreak linked to the chain's quarter pounders. Taylor Farms of Salinas, California has issued an onion recall. Other fast food chains are pulling onions from their menus as a precaution. Crude oil prices are up, but retail gasoline prices continue to fall. AAA says the average price at the pump is now $3.14 a gallon. That's down about a nickel from a week ago and 40 cents lower than this time last year. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. Actor and producer Alec Baldwin will not face another involuntary manslaughter trial for the accidental death of the cinematographer on the set of the movie Rust. NPR's Mandalito Barker reports a New Mexico judge has denied a motion to reopen the case.
In July, Alec Baldwin awaited his fate during a highly publicized trial. During a rehearsal for his Western film Rust in 2021, he was holding a prop gun loaded with what turned out to be live ammunition. The gun went off, wounding the film's director and killing cinematographer Helena Hutchins. During closing arguments, the judge ruled that prosecutors deliberately withheld evidence about bullets supplied to the film set, and she declared a mistrial. Now that same judge has denied a motion to reconsider criminal charges, ruling that prosecutors did not raise any factual or legal arguments that would justify a new trial. Baldwin and his film crew eventually finished production. Rust is set to premiere at a film festival in Poland in November. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.
Attention, Kmart shoppers. Actually, never mind, there are so few of you left, there's not much point. The company that once had more than 2,000 domestic stores now has just one. The sole surviving Kmart in the U.S. mainland is located in a suburban Miami shopping mall where it sits largely ignored. Put out of business by nimbler big box rivals like Walmart and Target, as well as online competitor Amazon, The Miami store became the last Kmart in the U.S. when a Long Island store closed last weekend. On Wall Street today, the Dow was down 259 points. The NASDAQ fell 103 points. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John Templeton Foundation, funding interdisciplinary research and catalyzing conversations to inspire awe and wonder. Information about the wonders of the universe is at templeton.org.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from the Topeka Zoo, presenting the 5th annual Zoo Lights, beginning November 22nd, with new light sections, appearances by Santa, and fun for all ages. Tickets available now at topekazoo.org.
It's 67 degrees in Lawrence. It is 73 in Chanute. Row 6.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Vice President Kamala Harris is making a final push to win over some very unlikely supporters, Republicans. And to do that, she's hitting the campaign trail with prominent GOP figures like former Congresswoman Liz Cheney.
You have to choose in this race between someone who has been faithful to the Constitution, who will be faithful, and Donald Trump.
NPR correspondents Sarah McCammon and Susan Davis have been reporting on these efforts and join us now. Hey to both of you.
Hey, Elsa.
Hi there.
Hi. Okay, Sarah, let's start with you. What exactly is the case that the campaign is making here?
So the phrase I've been hearing over and over again for months as I've been covering these efforts to win over Republicans for Harris's campaign is permission structure. And, you know, this is predicated on the idea that there are some voters out there who see themselves as conservative or Republican, may have consistently voted for Republicans in the past, but are looking for a reason and permission to vote differently this time around, especially after January 6th. And the message to these voters has been heavily focused on the idea of protecting democracy, on the idea that Trump poses a grave threat to American institutions. And to do that, they have relied on trusted messengers to make that case, like former Congresswoman Liz Cheney, who we just heard.
Right. And it's not just Cheney who's helping them, right?
Right. Just this week, local Republican officials in Wisconsin endorsed Harris, as did former Michigan Republican Congressman Fred Upton. Plus, she's been appearing with dozens of former Republicans who've endorsed her, including former members of Congress and former Trump administration officials. And these Republican supporters of Harris will say things like, look, we can argue about things like tax brackets later on. The objective now is to keep Trump from being elected again. Vice President Harris's campaign has announced that she will be making her closing arguments to voters next week on Tuesday at the Ellipse in D.C., an event that's intended to remind voters about January 6th.
Right. And Sue, you were in Pennsylvania this week. So I'm wondering, how is that messaging that Sarah's talking about right now resonating with voters there?
Well, first, Elsa, consider a little math. Pennsylvania is one of those states where Democrats think they can make an appeal here because earlier this year, nearly 160,000 Republicans, it was a closed primary, voted for South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley in the Republican primary. And that was well after she had dropped out of the race. Huh. And this is a state that Joe Biden won in 2020 with about 80,000 votes.
Yeah.
But I will tell you, these voters are hard to find. I was at that Cheney event earlier in the week. I spoke to a handful of voters. They said, oh, I'm an independent, but when I them. They had a history of voting consistently Democratic. That's not exactly the swing voter that Kamala Harris is looking for. I also spent time knocking doors with Americans for Prosperity. That's a conservative group that backed Haley in the primary and has not endorsed Trump and is focused on down ballot turnout. Every voter we came across was voting straight Republican ticket.
Okay, well then, did you find any swing voters?
Okay, they do exist. We did find one.
Okay.
Our colleagues at WQLN in Erie, Pennsylvania spoke to Joshua McGee. He's 22. He's a graduate student. He voted for Trump in 2020, and he said he's just recently made up his mind after attending a women's rally for abortion rights.
I didn't truly understand until after that how much women will suffer at the hands of Donald Trump if he is elected in 2024. And, you know, I know for certain that Kamala Harris will support women and support everyone for that matter. And I know Donald Trump does not support people that go against him.
Young male 2020 Republican voter, exactly the type of margin the Harris campaign is looking to chip away at.
Sure. Okay. Well, Sarah, I am curious about the other side of things. Is the Trump campaign trying to poach Democratic voters? And if so, like, who are those people?
You know, the Trump campaign isn't doing what the Harris campaign is doing. They're not running some kind of concerted effort to appeal to the other party. But there is polling that suggests that this is happening organically, with growing support for Trump among Black and Latino men, for instance. So Trump could also benefit from some small measure of Democratic crossover, too, from traditional Democratic voting blocs. The Trump campaign all along has been focused on turning out its base. There's been no real effort to appeal to political centrists, aside from a couple of comments Trump has made that appeared to try to soften his stance on opposition to abortion. But for the most part, he has appealed to his base. The campaign has projected confidence that those Nikki Haley primary voters that Sue mentioned will ultimately come home and vote for the Republican nominee. And Haley herself has, of course, endorsed Trump, though she hasn't campaigned for him much beyond that.
And look, there's a reason that the Trump campaign might be confident that Harris might not be able to eat too much into his margins. When the country's living through a supercharged, polarized election environment just like this one, the crossover vote is going to be pretty minimal. I spoke to Lee Mieringhoff. He's the polling director at Marist College, which is NPR's polling partner. And he said it's pretty hard for one party to pick up support in enemy territory.
And having said that, anything you pick up cross party lines is, in a close race, could be a huge factor. So it's, and on the one hand, don't look for double digit pickups across party lines. But if you're running 7 or 8%, I mean, that's like huge potentially.
And if this race is coming down to tight margins in those 7 swing states and all directions point to that, then those tiny movements for either campaign could have a major impact.
Indeed. That is NPR's Susan Davis and Sarah McCammon. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Both Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump have been courting swing voters in Pennsylvania, a self-proclaimed must-win state for both campaigns that polls show is evenly split between the candidates. One big political challenge for Harris is inflation. A Pew Research Center poll out last month found that 8 in 10 registered voters said the economy is their top issue in the election. Robert Benincasa from NPR's Investigations Unit visited the city of Pittsburgh to talk with voters about rising grocery prices and their choices in the election.
There's nothing like a trip to the grocery store to remind you of inflation.
We're charging $4 for the white eggs, which are grocery store eggs. We've been charging $6.25 a dozen for the brown farm eggs from our farmer.
Diane Schenk owns Dilamato's Market, a small, successful grocery store in Pittsburgh's Hazelwood neighborhood, a place where big supermarkets aren't within walking distance. In Pittsburgh, the price of eggs is up nearly 40% in the last year. That's among the highest across the nation's 50 top metro areas. NPR reached out to DataSembly Incorporated, a market intelligence company that tracks billions of grocery item prices every week. They gave us a year's worth of grocery price data for places all over the country, including Pittsburgh. Prices for fish and poultry here have dropped, even as beef and pork are up by 4 to 5%. And the impact on Steelers fans' tailgate parties has been minimal. The price of beer is up only 2%. Nationally, grocery prices have been cooling. They're up a bit over 1% in the last year. But that's after an increase of more than a quarter since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. So your $100 grocery bill in early 2020 is now about $126. Yadora Diamond, a former Hazelwood resident who returned to shop at Schenck's store, chatted with me as Schenck's husband rang up her order of fresh produce and sandwiches. She believes her grocery bill will be lower if former President Trump is elected, because she thinks he'll be better for fuel prices and farmers.
Even though he believes in the trickle-down effect, I just know how it was when he was in office. Financially, I was much better.
That sentiment is shared broadly by many Americans, according to polls. Just down the street, Bruce and Emily Thornton own the 111 Juice Bar, which offers cold-pressed fruits and vegetables. They've seen the cost of their ingredients increase. Bruce says He disagrees with some Biden administration policies and will reluctantly vote for Kamala Harris.
The reason why she's getting my vote is because I think it'll be a little bit, maybe a little better. I don't know, for us than the alternative. Well, she says she's willing to tax the upper class, and I believe that that is necessary. There needs to be a real tax on people who are making all this money, and then everyone else is kind of hurting.
The trouble with inflation numbers is that they aren't the only thing that can drive political attitudes. There's also the perception of inflation. A few years ago, Harvard Business School economist Alberto Cavallo scanned the receipts of shoppers outside grocery stores in Argentina, which was reeling from high inflation. He compared their beliefs about inflation to the real inflation rates affecting what they bought.
People do seem to put a lot of emphasis on the prices of things that they can connect to, so things that are in their basket. No, they seem to have these memories about the price increases, and that's what essentially drives their expectations of inflation.
The problem?
Their memories are really bad.
Cavallo found that shoppers often overestimated increases in the prices of their products and underestimated past prices. Back in Pittsburgh's Dilamato's Market, Schenck hears about grocery prices from her customers every day. But she says they've been showing some restraint when it comes to politics.
We don't have people going off about stuff they'd like to, but they kind of catch themselves and they're like, oh, well, you know, we're not going to talk politics.
At least not at the grocery store. Robert Benincasa, NPR News.
After winning 7 Super Bowls as a player, former NFL quarterback Tom Brady signed a 9-figure deal to be a TV commentator. Then he bought a stake in an NFL team, setting up a potential conflict of interest. How might Tom Brady have his team and talk about it too? That story on tomorrow's All Things Considered. If you aren't by your radio, try asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News on Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas. We're at 91.5 FM in Lawrence, also at 89.7 FM in Emporia. Lots of other frequencies, too, and always streaming at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from the Cider Gallery, a unique gallery space featuring works by local and regional artists, open Fridays, 1 to 5, and by appointment. Details at CiderGallery.com.
Coming up in our next half hour, news headlines, then an Israeli airstrike this morning has killed and injured some journalists. We'll get the latest on what we know and what we still don't know. Tell you all about a big comic book auction. There's a woman who is one of the only people in the world to collect every single DC comic ever published, her collection being auctioned off. And we will talk about that. Plus, Morgan Library in New York celebrating its 100th anniversary. We will hear about one of its most influential librarians coming up on KPR.
Support for KPR comes from Z's Divine Espresso, offering organic coffees via drive-thru windows and inside at 1800 East 23rd Street and 2351 West 31st in Lawrence. CoffeeInLawrence.com.
Stay tuned to KPR following the 7 o'clock news for a live broadcast from the Lawrence Public Library featuring violinist Destiny Ann Mermagan and friends. A whole night of spooky sounds for Halloween. Winding up KPR's annual live day. You will hear it at 7:06 tonight on your KPR 1 stations. If you're more of a KPR 2 person, stick around for Snap Judgment at 7 o'clock tonight. Lows in the mid-30s tonight under mostly clear skies. Tomorrow, sunny with a high in the mid-60s. It's 67 degrees in Lawrence, and it's 420.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie, Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, A tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is only in theaters this Thursday. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Nash County, North Carolina. Where Alex Cook, Adon Bermudez Bay, and other door knockers have spotted a registered voter. A voter getting into his black SUV to drive away, sure, but a voter nonetheless. They spring into action.
Yes, how you doing? Did we get 5 minutes of your time? 5 minutes.
It'll be worth it.
That voter, Ja'Kai Britton, says no, he's got to run. He's off to the airport. To this organizing team, the stakes for 2024, and in this state especially, are too high to let Britton go just yet.
3 minutes.
It's important. It's going to change your life.
2 minutes. All right. Yay, we got it, we got it.
And they're in. Britton, who is registered as a non-affiliated voter, says he's not planning on casting a ballot this year. Cook, from the organizing group Down Home North Carolina, starts peppering him with questions about the issues he's facing in his life.
You need health care, though, right? You get SSI, yes. So you need your health care.
Yes. I get SSI.
So do we have a vote for you?
You got a vote.
All right, let me give you some of this literature, sir.
From driving away to a conversation, from a no on voting to a maybe. All in the span of just a couple minutes.
Do you think he was just being polite to end the conversation, or do you think that's a vote?
I think it's a vote, because if he, at first he was saying no, 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 but once he realized that his Social Security can be affected from this, and his health care can be affected, and he's saying he got a mom in there, so I know she needs health care.
Down Home North Carolina is a nonprofit organizing in rural communities across the state. They say their platform is survival, helping poor and working-class people get basic needs met, like housing and education. In an election season like this one, they're mostly focused on local races, but they endorse candidates up and down the ticket, usually Democrats. Most of the time is spent urging residents, especially residents of color, to get out and vote.
We can't answer the door right now, but if you'd like to leave a message, you can do it now.
They don't open the door all the time, so 1 out of 10 doors, you might get someone.
And they typically face other challenges. There's a lot of walking in pretty hot weather, even in this time of year. And two different times, while we tag along with them, despite no laws being broken, patrol cars from the county sheriff linger near the organizers.
There's some police coming.
Oh, they caught the police, Adon.
Nash County is in a rural part of this key swing state. It's near evenly divided between white and black residents. In the recent presidential elections, it was near evenly divided by its results. President Joe Biden won the county by 0.2 of a point in 2020. 4 years before that, former President Donald Trump won it by the exact same razor-thin margin. But driving around the tiny town of Nashville, where they're canvassing today, it doesn't feel that way. There are Trump signs everywhere, a mix of homemade and official, plus plenty of MAGA flags. Still, Bermudez Bay and his team of volunteers are finding all of these Democratic doors to knock on.
What I notice is that there's a lot of people want to stay out the way. They see the Trump signs. They see what's going on in the school board, city council. They're just like, I'm going to stay out of it. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to tell them, like, there's an organization that specifically focuses in rural areas to pull those folks out, those who were hesitant.
This is the exact type of work that North Carolina State Democratic Chair Anderson Clayton says is crucial to building up the party's competitiveness in the Tar Heel state.
The single most powerful form of voter suppression is gerrymandering, like in any case scenario, because it makes people feel like their votes don't matter.
We talked to Clayton a few days before heading to Nash County. North Carolina has some of the most extreme partisan-drawn maps in the nation. The state has a Democratic governor in office, but Republicans hold a supermajority in the state house. Clayton, who's 26 and from rural Person County, has made reaching out to rural Democrats a key part of her strategy.
Joe Biden lost this state by 74,000 votes in 2020, which we know is a field margin, and that can come from all of our counties across the state.
That means juicing up turnout in the cities and suburbs, sure, but it also means convincing Democrats in more rural areas that their vote matters, that it's worth it to show up at the polls. It matters to the results, even if those extra votes are on the margins, because North Carolina has more rural voters than any other 2024 presidential swing state.
I'm not going to win rural North Carolina this year. Like, I'm trying to break back margins in it. There's a difference in talking or trying to talk to rural voters and talking to rural Democrats, and you need to do one before you do the other. And I'm like, I'm trying to talk to rural Democrats this year, people that showed up in 2008 that ain't showed up since because they haven't had somebody to vote for, and they didn't feel like their vote actually mattered.
Back in Nashville, down-home door knockers make their pitch to another potential voter.
Here are the candidates that we have endorsed, Josh Stein.
Sean Jones tells us he plans on voting, though in the presidential race, he hasn't quite made up his mind. He's leaning toward Vice President Kamala Harris.
I just recently went to go see my brother in prison this weekend, and he was kind of like on my head about it, like voting. He wanted me to vote for Trump, but I still wanted to vote for Kamala, so like, I'm still trying to like look into the politics as far as, like, what's what and who's who.
With 2 weeks to go before Election Day, finding a true undecided voter feels like a rarity. But Jones actually isn't the only voter we meet who tells us he's still unsure. Adon Bermudez Bay, Down Home's regional field director, fits that, though he's leading this group of canvassers who have endorsed Harris.
I don't know if I'm voting for Kamala yet, just full transparency. But I know that I'm definitely not voting for Trump.
Speaking just for himself, Bermudez Bay says he has concerns about Harris, her time as a prosecutor in California, her support for Israel during the ongoing war in the Middle East. He set a deadline for himself, November 2nd, the last day of early voting in North Carolina. That's when he'll decide between Harris or a third-party candidate. In the meantime, though, his pragmatic political side sees the merits of a Harris presidency, at least for Down Home's work.
No, it's not going to be perfect, but it's going to be a lot easier for us to organize under her presidency than Trump's.
That general feeling, the motivation of voting against Trump rather than for Harris, is in the air a dozen miles away at an early voting site in Rocky Mount, Nash County.
I just feel like Donald Trump is for billionaires and not for working class people.
Lynn Jones has just cast her ballot. She's walking back to the car with her neighbor, Donnell Jones, no relation, who has just voted for the very first time in his life.
No reason. I just didn't. That's all. No, it's about it. I just didn't ever do it.
Lynn says the two of them had a series of conversations in recent weeks about him joining her to vote.
I just thought, you know, he was at an age where this just should have happened a lot sooner. But I know sometimes people are stuck in their ways, so I didn't pressure him. Just, hey, let's go vote together then.
And the result?
I voted for the lady.
Was one more vote in the bank for Harris. If Democrats are going to win Nash County and win North Carolina, it's going to be through thousands of interactions like what Down Home is doing and what, on a more casual level, Lynn Jones did with Donnell Jones, nudging others to show up and vote, regardless of how disengaged or skeptical they were at the beginning of those conversations. On tomorrow's All Things Considered, we look at a key part of Trump's coalition in North Carolina, conservative Christian voters, and talk to a Raleigh pastor about why they've stuck with Trump through all the years, as our series, We the Voters, continues.
This is NPR News.
North Carolina is seen by many as a must-win state for Donald Trump. A key part of his constituency there, conservative Christians.
You can have some people with some pretty deep moral struggles who are upholding a platform that we support.
One North Carolina religious leader on why Trump's support from conservative Christians runs so deep. That's on All Things Considered.
Join us tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock on your KPR stations for Weekend All Things Considered.
Support for KPR comes from the Lead Center, hosting comedian Lewis Black in Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, the final tour, Saturday, November 2nd, 7:30 p.m. Tickets are available at lead.ku.edu.
Stay with us. News headlines are coming up next. It's 67 degrees in Lawrence, 69 in Emporia, 68 in Manhattan. The time is 4:30.
It's
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Coming up, a new exhibit explores the groundbreaking path of Belle DaCosta Green.
She was the first director of New York's Morgan Library.
There's not only the racial issues she was up against, but the gender ones as well. I mean, she becomes director very shortly after women gained the right to vote.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Both presidential candidates are stumping in Texas leading up to the final days of the general election. Former President Donald Trump is holding his first public event in the border state since receiving the Republican nomination, where he's expected to underscore his focus on immigration. Yesterday, Trump called the U.S. a dumping ground or trash can for immigrants. Here's what Vice President Kamala Harris had to say about that today.
This is someone who is a former president of the United States who has a bully pulpit. And this is how he uses it, to tell the rest of the world that somehow the United States of America is trash.
Meanwhile, the Harris campaign is making a final push to win over Texas voters today by putting abortion rights at the forefront. Russia's President Vladimir Putin says the Kremlin will not bend in its demands in order to achieve peace in Ukraine. His comments came at a summit hosted by Russia for developing nations, including major powers India and China. Here's NPR's Charles Maines.
Putin has repeatedly insisted any negotiations over Ukraine hinged on Kyiv recognizing what he calls the new reality. In essence, Russia's right to annex four Ukrainian territories, Moscow claims, but is never fully controlled. In an interview on Russian state television, Putin said Moscow would make no concessions and expressed confidence in recent Russian advances on the battlefield. Putin also noted a recent change in the West's rhetoric on Ukraine, implying Western nations now understood Russia could not be defeated. He also appeared to soften earlier comments that suggested thousands of North Korean troops were already in Russia and en route to fight in Ukraine, saying it was still an open question. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
Stocks finished mixed on Wall Street as companies continue to report mostly solid profits from the last quarter. This is NPR News.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Laura Lorson with your regional headlines. The cities of Hayes and Russell are suing nearby Edwards County for attempts to slow down a water transfer project. The cities say a lack of water due to drought and low available groundwater is a threat to their residents. 30 years ago, the cities purchased a ranch in Edwards County to draw groundwater for the municipalities. Since then, the city manager for Hayes, Toby Doherty, has said it's been years of regulatory hurdles.
There are people in Edwards County that don't like seeing that water leave their area. Well, that water leaves their area every day in corn and cattle and hogs and dairies.
An attorney for Edwards County says he's still reviewing the lawsuit. Kansas wildlife officials hope to block an invasive carp from moving upstream of a dam in Lawrence. The Bowersock Dam on the Kansas River is a relatively low one. And silver carp, it turns out, are excellent jumpers. When the river is high, they could leap over the hydroelectric dam. So the Kansas Department of Wildlife and Parks is planning to install a kind of grate. Liam Odell is a biologist with the agency.
The way I can describe it is it'll kind of be like these metal fingers will come off of that north powerhouse where we're worried about them potentially jumping over, and those will prevent that from being able to get that, achieve enough height to go into the other side.
Wildlife officials want to block this species because it's a prolific spawner that grows fast and competes with native fish for food. The 16th-ranked Kansas State Wildcats are still in the running for a Big 12 football championship. They are hoping to avoid a stumble at 7 o'clock Saturday night in Manhattan against the KU Jayhawks. Greg Eklund has this preview.
Only BYU and Iowa State remain unbeaten in the Big 12, both with 4-0 conference records and 7-0 overall. But the Wildcats are tied with three other teams with 3-1 conference records. The Wildcats have beaten KU 15 straight times, but Wildcats coach Chris Kleiman says he had no plans to bring up the topic.
The last few years have been really competitive games, and we've found a way. Last year we were down 11 in the second half and found a way.
KU enters the game with an overall record of 2-5 and won its first conference game last weekend against Houston. I'm Greg Eklund.
And a high-profile charity exhibition basketball game gets underway tonight between the top-ranked Kansas Jayhawks and the Arkansas Razorbacks. The Jayhawks, who were ranked the preseason number one, will play before a sold-out crowd in Fayetteville at 8 o'clock. Mostly clear skies tonight with a low in the mid-30s. Tomorrow, sunshine and a high in the mid-60s. Lows in the lower 40s tomorrow night. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio, and it's 4:35.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Three journalists were killed by Israeli airstrikes in Lebanon today. The guest house where they had been staying with other journalists came under attack in the early morning. NPR's Arzu Rizvani spoke with one of them who survived the airstrikes.
The journalists would spend their days in southern Lebanon, pretty much at the front lines of the war between Hezbollah and Israeli forces. They'd spend their nights at a guest house in the small town of Husbaya, away from the fighting. It felt safe there. It had become a refuge for many journalists from international news organizations, including Sky News Arabia and Al Jazeera, and it hadn't been a target of Israeli airstrikes before. The journalists made sure their cars were clearly labeled press, and as an added precaution, many had also given their whereabouts to UN peacekeepers, who are typically in contact with Israeli military. Hassan Hoteit of Al Ghayra News was among the group of journalists. He said after a long day, many had turned in early for the night. And then, at 3 a.m., it happened.
I woke up to the sound of loud rattling and glass shattering, and suddenly I felt a great weight upon my body. I couldn't move. I couldn't move at all. And I thought this is the moment that could be the moment of my death.
Other surviving journalists pulled Hoteit out from under the rubble. But cameraman Ghassan Najjar, camera operator Wissam Ghassam, and engineer Mohammed Rida were all killed. They worked for broadcasters Al-Manar, a network operated by Hezbollah, and Al-Mayadeen, a pro-Iran, pro-Palestinian news channel. Hoteit believes Israel is going after journalists for their coverage of this war, here in Lebanon and in Gaza. And he believes Israel's military has free rein to do so.
With Israel, there are no normal rules of engagement. They say when you are fighting an enemy, leave them a path to retreat so that they don't become vicious. Israel has no respect for that, even though they have superiority. They struck us while we were sleeping. But those who massacred children, it's easy for them to kill journalists.
Hoteit is now recovering from his injuries at a hospital in Beirut. He has the TV on. It's turned to the news. He's watching coverage of the very airstrike he survived. Lebanon's information minister said the attack was deliberate and called the deaths a war crime. Israel's military says it hit a Hezbollah military structure in the same town where Hoteit and the others were attacked today. It said it later learned that journalists were among the casualties and added, quote, the incident is under review. Arzu Rizvani, NPR News, Beirut.
The WNBA is wrapping up a historic year. In-game attendance and viewership all reached record highs, and the buzz around the league is louder than ever. The salaries of players, however, don't seem to match that success.
Yes, that went off, though.
The WNBA, you know, if you want us to be here, you have to pay us more. It's business.
Everyone, buckle up. It's about to be a fun day.
This is our opportunity to get it right.
And that's why this week, just a day after the end of the season, the league's labor union decided to opt out of its upcoming collective bargaining agreement. Players are asking for higher wages, improved benefits, and a larger share of the media rights deal it shares with the NBA. Neka Ogumake is a forward with the Seattle Storm and the president of the Women's National Basketball Players Association. That's the players' union that represents the league. We asked her about that deal specifically and what she thought about the WNBA's share.
Well, I mean, it's certainly groundbreaking in that it greatly surpasses any media deals we've had before. I'm hoping that it doesn't limit what we can also, how we can also market and brand ourselves as the WNBA as we continue to sustain through this unique growth that the WNBA is having. But as you know, with the numbers that are being thrown out, we're going to want to be able to share in that value, share in that growth. And I look forward to seeing how the intricacies of a deal like that can be reflected in how we compensate the players as well.
Does having a bigger piece of the pie create a future where the WNBA's revenue is less dependent on the success of another league? Specifically, we're talking about the NBA here.
You know, I mean, we can never ignore the great support that we get from the NBA, but I do love that, you know, the WNBA is forming its own path and sustaining itself. And, you know, as big as both leagues are, and as similar as you can find them to be, the difference is what really makes us very special. And I'm excited to know that we are getting opportunities and investment that are unique to us. And I look forward to seeing how much we can really make that exponential growth.
A work stoppage is possible if talks fall through, and that would be a first for the league. With all of the progress that's been made this year, what would that mean for the momentum that the WNBA has going into next season?
Well, you know, I mean, with all of the attention and the visibility that we have on the WNBA today, you know, even with the conclusion of this season, there's so much movement and so many changes as people are really experiencing this surge and this excitement. You know, we're looking forward to an expansion draft. And I think at the conclusion of the 2025 season, there will continue to be eyes on us, even in the offseason, especially as we renegotiate in anticipation of the 2026 season. So, you know, work stoppage is by far not what we hope for, but it's something that we definitely prepare for. But we are really seeking a very collaborative negotiation that can land the players where we feel like our value is met.
The amount of growth that the WNBA has seen in this year and the last couple of years has really been astronomical. Do you worry at all that there is a risk that the growth that we've seen isn't sustainable?
I don't worry about that at all. I think that we've been in a space where what the public is feeling and seeing is something that we've always known. And this new era is just us realizing that people see us for what we are. I'm just excited to be a part of it. I'm excited to be actively playing while this is happening so I can use my platform and leadership in ways to contribute to this historical moment.
Nneka, you have called these negotiations a defining moment for the WNBA. What do you think that the decisions that are being made by leadership right now will mean both for future generations of players, but also future fan bases?
I mean, we're really in a transformational moment. You know, I think that today we have players that are fighting for the fair share of the business that we built. You know, there is no product without the players. And we know that our success is the league's success. We know our business. We know we are a part of this business, and we want to be a part of the generational growth of this business so we can leave this league better than when we entered it.
Nneka Ogwumike is a forward with the Seattle Storm and the president of the WNBA Players Association. Nneka, thank you.
Thank you.
If you're a regular listener of All Things Considered or our sister podcast, Consider This, you can now check out the Consider This newsletter. We help you break down one major story of the day, but you'll also get to know our producers, our hosts, and some fun stories from the All Things Considered team. You can sign up at npr.org/consider this newsletter. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. In the early 2000s, Vermont resident Christine Farrell amassed a collection of everything published by DC Comics. She's believed to be the first person to have achieved this feat. Her collection of more than 30,000 comics begins in 1935 and features the first appearances of heroes like Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman. Farrell died in April, and as Vermont Public's Liam Elder Connors reports, some of the rarest comics in her collection will now be sold.
Christine Farrell started reading comic books when she was a kid and began her collection in her teenage years. In 1995, Farrell took Mountain Lake PBS on a tour of her house where she kept her collection. Comics were piled in overflowing banker's boxes and stacked on the floor. It was messy, but there appeared to be some organization. In the video, Farrell pulled a comic from a container labeled Wonder Woman, issues 121 to 145.
This one, I paid a whopping 12 cents for.
It was 1963 at the time.
At first, Farrell says she favored comics with female leads, like Lois Lane and Supergirl. But soon, she says she was buying all of them.
I'm a pack rat. I didn't know it until I turned into a teenager, but pack rats are born, not made, and apparently I was born a pack rat.
In the early 1980s, Farrell opened a comic book shop in Burlington, Vermont's largest city. But as she told Mountain Lake PBS, she collected the comics because she was a fan.
I buy them because I want to read them. Although my reading is about 10 years behind, but not for resale, not at all. I do not intend to sell the collection.
But now, after Farrell's death, about 500 of her rarest comics will go to the highest bidders this weekend. Dallas, Texas-based Heritage Auctions is handling the sale. Vice President Lon Allen estimates this weekend's auction could bring in $4 million, with Superman's 1938 debut likely to fetch the highest price. Allen says the collection contains other rarities, too, like one called Double Action Comics. There are only 7 copies known to still exist.
It's so steeped in mystery, nobody really understands what it is or where it came from. So it's something that's just impossible to value.
It's comics like that that make Farrell's collection so special to Stephen Bissett, a Vermonter and comic book artist. His work includes illustrating Swamp Thing and the 19 writer Alan Moore's run on the series. For Bissett, it's not the monetary value that matters. It's the artistic and creative history that's contained in the thousands of comics Farrell collected.
Chris had every issue of their science fiction comics, Strange Adventures, House of Secrets, Challenges of the Unknown. I mean, these are titles that don't register with the public at large, but they had amazing stories. And that's where, to me, the creative juices are.
The auction this weekend is focused on the older and more high-end comics in Farrell's collection. The rest will likely be sold at Farrell's comic book store, Earth Prime Comics. For NPR News, I'm Liam Elder Connors in Burlington, Vermont.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Hey, it's A. Martinez. Research shows that keeping up with news helps people engage more knowledgeably in public life. And you know that Morning Edition from NPR News is a news show that covers all aspects of public life, from politics to business to culture and entertainment. Knowledge that might be even more useful in, oh, say, an election year? Engage with Morning Edition every weekday.
You can do that by tuning into KPR Monday through Friday, 5 to 9 a.m. From the University of Kansas, this is Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 99.5 FM in Manhattan, always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from KU Theater, presenting Hookman, a darkly comic salute to teenage slasher films, reminding everyone that college can be scary. Playing November 1st through November 7th. Tickets at kutheater.com.
Stay with us. News headlines coming up at 5:01. Then the Republican National Committee has already started filing some lawsuits over voter fraud even before Election Day.
By filing some of these cases now, the RNC may be hoping that the existence of these earlier suits somehow helps their cause then.
I suppose we'll find out. When that happens, we'll tell you more about the legal battles being faced by both parties. Also, a report from the front lines of the Gaza war coming up on KPR.
Support for KPR comes from the University of Kansas, transforming students and society through academics, discovery, service, and spirit. Information about the possibilities of a KU education is online at ku.edu.
Mostly clear skies tonight, lows in the mid-30s. Tomorrow, sunshine with a high in the mid-60s. Warming up at the beginning of the next work week, though. 67 degrees in Lawrence. It's 10 minutes before 5.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. The Army today released a police report concerning an altercation between two Trump campaign staffers and an employee at Arlington National Cemetery. The incident took place back in August. That day, Donald Trump laid a wreath commemorating the third anniversary of the withdrawal from Afghanistan and the 13 U.S. service members who were killed by a terrorist bomb. NPR's Tom Bowman joins us in the studio now. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Juana.
So, Tom, I know you broke the story about this incident back in August. Why is the report coming out now?
Well, it's a result of a court order calling on the Army to release a police report after a lawsuit filed by American Oversight, which pushes for the release of government records. The report leaves a lot of questions, though. It's dated August 29th. All names are removed. Doesn't say whether Trump staffers were interviewed by police. It just indicates an altercation. Report says the words "with both hands" attempted to move past, says his staffer did not require medical attention, filed a sworn statement, and did not press charges. The report says, by the way, the investigation continues. So what happened here was after Trump laid the wreath, he and his aides went to Section 60 of the cemetery, reserved for those from the Iraq and Afghan wars. But the Trump team brought their own photographers and videographers, and that's not allowed.
Right.
Only official cemetery photographers. So this employee was shoved aside by these aides, and campaign photos and videos were taken.
At the time, Tom, what did the Trump campaign have to say about all this?
Well, they said they were invited to Section 60 by Gold Star families, those who lost loved ones in that terrorist bombing. And they said the cemetery employee had a mental breakdown, which the Army strongly denied, and said the employee was abruptly pushed aside. Then Donald Trump went on to say it was a made-up story, which, of course, a police report indicates it was not. It was a campaign issue for a time. Kamala Harris, her supporters, and some military officials, former military officials, said it all showed the Trump campaign's disrespect for the cemetery.
Interesting developments, Tom. So is this the end of all this?
Well, you know, we're not sure. The report says the employee declined to press any charges, so there's no sense of any court action, let's say. Through a source back in August, NPR did identify the Trump staffers, Justin Caparol and Michael Picard, who did not respond to emails. Trump spokesman Stephen Chung did, and he just said Trump was there to support Gold Star families.
NPR's Tom Bowman, thanks.
You're welcome.
The name Belle DaCosta Green might not ring a bell, but New York's renowned historic Morgan Library and Museum is trying to change that. A new exhibit called A Librarian's Legacy opens today, just in time for the Morgan's 100th anniversary. It traces Green's life and her lasting influence as the library's first director and collector. It was an unusually prominent role for a woman at the time, a woman who chose to pass as white to survive in a highly segregated America. The Morgan Library was built and founded by J. Pierpont Morgan, one of the richest and most powerful bankers in the early 20th century. It houses a one-of-a-kind collection of medieval writings, rare books, and illuminated manuscripts, thanks in large part to Belle DaCosta Green. Erica Chilella is an exhibit curator for A Librarian's Legacy at the Morgan Library, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk about Belle Green.
Oh, well, we're so excited to have you. So just explain, first of all, like, how did Belle DaCosta Green come to be associated with the Morgan Library in the first place?
Yeah, so she just was working as a librarian at Princeton University and really caught the attention of a gentleman by the name of Junius Morgan, who was an associate librarian there and just happened to be the nephew of Pierpont Morgan, who was at this time in the city wondering what to do with his amazing collection he had already start to collect and was unfortunately just kind of everywhere in his home. And he decided to build a library next door to his townhouse on Madison. And he needed a librarian to run it. And Junius said, I think I have the perfect person for you. And in 1905, she began working for Pierpont Morgan as his librarian, cataloging his collection, and eventually stewarding this amazing building that we have and are celebrating still today.
I love that. I want to talk a little bit about her personal story because Green, I mean, she was a black woman, but she didn't live her life publicly as a black woman. She chose to pass as white. Can you talk about that? Like, why she felt she had to do that? How did she do that? Please tell me more.
Yes, of course. I mean, the decision to pass was actually a family choice, and it was really spearheaded by her mother, Genevieve, who not only made the decision for all of Green and her siblings to pass, but did it fairly early on when Green was still in school. She had lived in Washington, D.C. She had lived previously in South Carolina and really saw the struggles of what it meant to be African-American in this country, what it was like during Reconstruction in the South. And so she really kind of knew that in order to move forward, sometimes you have to do what you have to do.
Did anyone ever suspect that she was not white? Do you know of any incident, any confrontation?
We do know that, like, newspaper reporters, they would always point out her dark hair or her wild hair or the darker skin color.
Her wild hair. Wow. And do you have any sense of what that did in the long term to her psyche, her identity, passing as white day to day for so much of her life?
She had a 10-volume set of diaries, and she does burn these before she passes away. But we do have a letter she wrote to the art historian Bernard Berenson, where she said that that is where she wrote things down that she dare not even think to herself. So what that means, unfortunately, we're never going to know. But I mean, it's got to have been a struggle. And I mean, it's actually incredible that she was made director as a woman.
Yeah.
I mean, most directors of these kinds of institutions were not women at this time either. So she had, you know, there's not only the racial issues she was up against, but the gender ones as well. I mean, she becomes director very shortly after women gained the right to vote. So, I mean, this is really an important time in American history to think of what women's rights in general were at this time and how much she was saying, I'm not going to conform to these ideals. I'm going to be my own person.
That's so cool. How would you characterize her larger legacy outside of the Morgan Library, looking back on all of this?
She really believed in accessing a collection, being able to use a collection, that it shouldn't just sit on a shelf, that she really wanted people to interact with that. And that's something that librarians today hold dear, but it wasn't the trend back then. And she really was a trailblazer for a special collection being used and not just something pretty you look at, but what can we learn from it? How do we access it? And that everyone, she really believed that everyone should have access to these materials, not just the super wealthy. And I think that is really a testament to her and the legacy she leaves behind to a much more larger library community.
I can't wait to check this out. Erica Chilella, an exhibit curator for A Librarian's Legacy, the Morgan Library's exhibit on its first ever director and librarian, Belle DaCosta Green. It opens today in New York. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Erica.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is only in theaters this Thursday. From C3 AI, C3 Generative AI works to enable rapid access to hallucination-free insights from enterprise systems using any LLM, helping turn the invisible into the obvious. This is Enterprise AI. From San Jose State University, with 100-plus graduate and research programs ranging from AI to wildfire science, their graduates and their ideas are working to fuel innovation in Silicon Valley and beyond. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
Friday, October 25th at 7 p.m. at the Lawrence Public Library, a free show by yours truly, Destiny from Evening Classical, playing the violin in the flesh. See you there.
That is tonight. Again, that gets underway at 7 o'clock tonight, Lawrence Public Library. More information at our website, kansaspublicradio.org. We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1, Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1, Emporia 89.7. KANV and KANV HD1, Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3, Listen on the web at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio. We are expecting a low in the mid-30s tonight. It's 67 in Lawrence. It's 5 o'clock.
We have seen a close to a four-year campaign to really degrade trust in our election system.
Election Day is almost here, and the results of this election are already being litigated.
For Friday, October 25th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This hour to Gaza, where Israeli military operations against Hamas are intensifying.
The situation is very, very, very bad.
I feel fatigue and nausea and dizziness. I didn't eat yesterday.
Also a conversation with singer-songwriter Laura Marling.
She's out with her eighth album, Patterns in Repeat.
Of course, what I didn't understand or foresee is that the experience of becoming a parent really cracks you open.
And game one of the World Series is today.
The New York Yankees face off against the Los Angeles Dodgers.
First the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Well, the former President Trump and Vice President Harris are campaigning in Texas today. Harris will be campaigning tonight with Colin Allred, who's taking on Senator Ted Cruz, as Democrats try to flip the seat blue. Trump, meanwhile, is in Austin recording a podcast with Joe Rogan, and Bureau's Deepa Chivram reports.
Harris called out Trump for targeting immigrants by calling America the garbage can of the world. She said it was an example of how Trump, quote, belittles the country.
This is someone who is a former president of the United States who has a bully pulpit. And this is how he uses it, to tell the rest of the world that somehow the United States of America is trash.
Trump repeated that rhetoric in Austin, calling the U.S. a dumping ground and saying Texas is, quote, ground zero for illegal immigration, which he referred to as a, quote, border invasion. Deepa Chivram, NPR News, Houston.
President Biden traveled to Arizona today, where he apologized in person for some of the worst atrocities carried out against Native Americans by the U.S. government. Speaking about the abuses and deaths of Native children to government-run boarding schools that for decades forcibly separated children from their parents, Biden called it a blot on American history and a sin on our soul. Democrats hope the president's visit to the Gila River Indian community's land on the outskirts of Phoenix will provide a lift for the Harris campaign in that key battleground. State. The man who helped anchor the sound of the psychedelic jam band The Grateful Dead has died. Bassist Phil Lesh provided some of the soaring harmonies of the group's most popular songs. As a founding member of the group, he also co-wrote songs including Saint Stephen and Dark Star. Phil Lesh was 84 years old. The Biden administration has unveiled its latest effort to reduce or wipe out debt for millions of federal student loan borrowers. Here's NPR's Corey Turner.
This is Biden's third big try at student loan relief. The Supreme Court killed the first one. Another that would have helped people who owe more than they originally borrowed is tied up in the courts. And now the Education Department has proposed a set of rules to offer relief to borrowers experiencing what it calls financial hardship, like having to care for a loved one with chronic illness or struggling in the aftermath of a natural disaster. These would be borrowers who, the department predicts, are highly likely to default on their loans within 2 years, about 8 million people, by the department's math. The rule won't be finalized until next year, and like previous efforts, is almost certain to be challenged in court. Corey Turner, NPR News.
Stocks gave up at least some of their earlier gains to close generally lower on Wall Street to wind down the trading week. The Dow fell 259 points to 42,114. The Nasdaq was up 103 points. The S&P 500 fell a point. You're listening to NPR. Palestinian health officials say Israeli strikes killed at least 38 people in southern Gaza today. That includes a large extended family, 13 of whom were children. In northern Gaza, health officials say Israeli forces raided a hospital there, where the military's renewed its offensive against Hamas and aid groups are sounding the alarm over dire humanitarian conditions. The number of people sickened as a result of McDonald's Quarter Pounder hamburgers has now risen to 75. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says an outbreak of E. coli has spread to at least 13 states, with 22 people now hospitalized. Officials say they're focusing on raw slivered onions used in some McDonald's hamburgers. So far, one person has died as a result of the outbreak. An Old Norse saga tells of a dead man hurled into a well in the 12th century. Reporting Ari Daniel says DNA suggests what this person may have looked like and where he came from.
Excavations of the well revealed a man's skeleton, possibly that of the person described in the saga. Archaeologists and evolutionary genomicists teamed up to extract enough DNA from the root of one of the teeth to sequence the individual's genome. Michael Martin is at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology.
We were able to deduce that he was a male. We could say that he was very likely to have blue eyes, blonde hair, and an intermediate skin tone, and that his ancestry traces back to a very specific county in southern Norway.
Martin says the genomic analysis adds new detail to the centuries-old saga, a story that may have its moments of exaggeration, but that is overall rooted in fact. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from the Topeka Zoo, offering zoo memberships for individuals and families alike for unlimited admission to the zoo year-round. Details on the benefits of a Topeka Zoo membership can be found at topekazoo.org.
66 degrees in Lawrence, 68 in Manhattan. The time is 5:06.
From NPR News, this is All Things Hang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
Election Day is less than 2 weeks away, and no matter what happens on November 5th, Republicans and Democrats are preparing for a lengthy battle over the results. Already, there have been dozens and dozens of lawsuits filed that challenge how elections are run in this country, and many Americans have already voted. Here to walk us through what could happen next month and into the new year is Jessica Marsden, Director of Impact Programs for Free and Fair Elections at Protect Democracy. Jessica, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jessica, I just want to start with the fact that there are already a number of lawsuits and legal issues that have been filed, and we haven't even gotten to Election Day yet. What can you tell us about what we know about them? What kinds of themes are emerging?
Yeah, these last minute challenges hit on a few themes. One is we've seen a number of suits from the RNC and affiliated conservative organizations challenging voter eligibility, saying in essence that there are a number, thousands in some cases, of voters who are registered to vote who shouldn't be, whether that be because they are non-citizens or there's some other issue with their eligibility. Another category of cases I'd point to has to do with overseas voting. Just in the past few weeks, we've seen cases in North Carolina, Michigan, and Pennsylvania challenging those states' procedures for allowing overseas citizens, including members of the military, to participate this fall.
Help us unpack the Republican strategy here and why those types of lawsuits are coming now.
One strategy that may lay behind filing these lawsuits now goes back to 2020, where many of those cases were dismissed by courts because the cases were brought too late. You can't wait until after an election to challenge a voter's eligibility to cast his or her ballot. So it seems likely that by filing some of these cases now, even though they don't stand a chance of getting relief before the election, the RNC may be readying to make some of those same arguments after the election and hoping that the existence of these earlier suits somehow helps their cause then.
So we talked about some of the lawsuits that the Republican National Committee has filed, but what about the Democrats? What kind of suits have they brought?
In general, the Democrats have been bringing fewer cases than the Republicans this year. And often they are intervening in cases that were initially brought by Republicans. So you do end up, you know, with the two parties on opposite sides of a lawsuit. But one unusual thing this year is that I think we've seen more of these cases coming from Republican groups.
You know, I have to imagine that most voters, they don't follow the ins and outs of election and some of this litigation as closely as you and I do, but if they're hearing this conversation, they might be concerned if they've already cast a ballot or they're preparing to cast one. What would you say to people who might be feeling some of that anxiety around all of this?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in many states, you can actually follow up with your local election office and see, you know, if you've cast a mail-in ballot, was it counted? Was that ballot accepted? But in general, I just remind voters that if they are closely following the instructions from their election offices, their vote's going to count.
With being as close to election day as we are, and with the fact that this is a race by all projections, it's going to be quite close. What concerns you the most when you look at the landscape?
I think the fact that we have seen a close to a four-year campaign to really degrade trust in our election system, and that you know, has led some voters to lose faith in the election process is probably my biggest concern. I'd encourage folks with questions about the trustworthiness of our election process to spend some time, you know, on the website of your local election office. You know, there are a number of really excellent election officials who are putting out good information that will walk folks through the process of how their vote gets cast and counted. That kind of information, I hope, can start to dispel some of the fear and anxiety that voters may have about this process.
That was Jessica Marsden, lawyer and director of Impact Programs for Free and Fair Elections at Protect Democracy. Jessica, thank you.
Thanks so much.
This is the 385th day of war in Gaza. For people there, it's death, not life, that feels certain. NPR correspondent Aya Betraoui and producer Anas Baba report on how Israeli military operations against Hamas are intensifying.
This week, some 20,000 people streamed out of the town of Jabalia in North Gaza, traumatized and exhausted, ordered by lethal drones hovering in the sky to leave their homes after 3 weeks under siege. Amir Saleh was one of them. He tells NPR over the phone how families like his walked more than 2 miles south to Gaza City, past wounded people who couldn't be carried. Along the way, Saleh walked past Jabalia's Indonesian hospital, besieged by an Israeli tank. He says people in the hospital cried out, "Water, water," but he says no one could help. The army fired on anyone who tried. Inside that hospital, a nurse sent this voice memo heard by NPR.
The situation is very, very, very bad.
The nurse, whose name we're not publishing for his safety, says the military has been ordering hospital staff to leave, but they refuse to abandon the patients.
I feel fatigue and nausea and dizziness. I didn't eat from yesterday.
Outside, Saleh was separated from his wife and kids. He says all males over 13 years old were taken by Israeli soldiers and ordered to sit in a dirt hole. Then, in groups of four, they were told to face cameras for scans. Tanks flanked them. Some were detained. Saleh was among those released hours later. Gaza civil defense say also at least 500 people, including doctors and aid workers, have been killed in the siege, but that many are still trapped under the rubble. Israel's military says its operation in Jabalia has killed and detained hundreds of Hamas militants trying to regroup and uncovered rocket launchers. Here's Israeli government spokesman David Mentzer.
These are heartbreaking images of civilians on the move. Again, we understand that fact. But of course, it's much better to get them out of harm's way.
For Saleh, there is nowhere in Gaza that is out of harm's way. He's tried evacuating before, but says while he was sheltering in a hospital in December, Israeli tank fire killed his 3-year-old son Karim while he was cradling him. Saleh says during this current siege, he told his wife, "I wish death for us all together, so none of us has to mourn the other." But it's not just the north. All of Gaza has become a kill zone. In the middle and south, people despair. Another Israeli airstrike on a school sheltering displaced families killed 18 people, 11 of them children, on Thursday in central Gaza. Israel says it was targeting a Hamas figure inside. A teenage boy cries over the body of his niece, just 9. Bara Alfar says Jenna had left the north only 6 days ago after facing starvation there for this. Starve or leave, that's what some in Israel say they want. At a rally in Israel near Gaza's border this week, settlers and senior government officials called for Palestinians to be expelled from Gaza to make way for Jewish settlements. They're hopeful the military's operations could make that happen. Aya Batraoui, NPR News Dubai, with reporting by Anas Baba in Gaza.
The New York Yankees and Los Angeles Dodgers are facing off in the World Series. Yes, big hitters brought him there.
Aaron Judge finally connects his first home run of this postseason.
There's a drive. It's a bullet. Was there any doubt? Shohei Ohtani.
But so did a passion for the game. And as sports fans know, fandom is often something you inherit. It gets passed down from generation to generation.
That's the case for two current players on the Yankees, shortstop Anthony Volpe and pitcher Gerrit Cole.
Earlier this week, Volpe's dad shared a picture on Instagram of young Anthony Volpe at the 2009 Yankees Victory Parade in Manhattan.
That was the last time the team won a championship. Now the 23-year-old is considered one of the best young talents in the sport.
Here's how announcers described the hometown kid in his first major league game in the Bronx last season.
Anthony didn't just want to play Major League Baseball. He wanted to play shortstop for the New York Yankees. Born in Manhattan, wanted to be the next Derek Jeter. Is that the last World Series parade? Is that the All-Star game here in 14? Fulfilling his dream. Opening day shortstop of the Yankees, Anthony Volpe.
Volpe jokes that he didn't really have much of a choice when it came to picking a team. The Yankees lineage in his family dates back to his great-grandfather. Here's Volpe after his team clinched a spot in the World Series.
I always dream, but this doesn't even do it justice. You always dream of going to the World Series and playing games like this, but to be on a team like this with the guys and how close you are, it's a family, and that's what makes it better.
His teammate, Gerrit Cole, on the other hand, rooted for the team from the other side of the country in Southern California. When Cole signed his contract for the Yankees in 2019, Cole took a childhood memento to his introductory press conference.
It was a sign he'd held up in the ballpark as a kid that read, Yankee fan, today, tomorrow, forever.
I just love the Yankees. My dad was a Yankee fan, and he just introduced me to the Yankees. It was just hard not to love Derek Jeter and the crew, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s. I mean, it's kind of like, how can you not be a Lakers fan in Southern California when Kobe and Shaq were doing their thing?
It seems fitting that the former captain, Derek Jeter, inspired two young kids 3,000 miles apart to grow up and bring the Yankees back to the World Series.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is your place for NPR News from the University of Kansas. Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 89.9 FM in Atchison. And we are always online, streaming at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from Cromwell Solar, installing solar since 1982 and now offering whole backup battery systems, such as Tesla Powerwalls for Kansas and Missouri. More information at cromwellsolar.com.
Stay with us. Coming right up, the Washington Post publisher says the paper will not be endorsing a presidential candidate in this year's race, that its job is to be independent. This has caused a bit of a firestorm. David Folkenflik has been all over this story. He'll tell us what he knows at this point. Then Laura Marling, British musician, has a brand new album out, and we are going to talk about it.
It's very easy to accommodate this new enormous thing into your life and continue to have these things that drive you and make you who you are.
She's talking about children, and that is all coming up here on KPR. Stick around.
Support for KPR comes from the Yoga Center of Lawrence, providing Lawrence and surrounding communities with yoga instruction by Iyengar yoga instructors since 1999. Class schedule and registration information at yogacenteroflawrence.org.
Mostly clear skies tonight with a low in the mid-30s. Tomorrow, highs in the mid-60s, lows in the lower 40s tomorrow night. Back into the mid-70s for Sunday, back into the mid to upper 80s for Monday. And then what a surprise, things cool down again. At least that's how things look here a few days out. KPR's Big Band Christmas is coming again Saturday night, December 14th. Kansas City Jazz Orchestra returns. The Scoop at kansaspublicradio.org. Tickets are on sale now at Liberty Hall and Ticketmaster.com. Made possible in part by Dr. Stephen H. Chronister, Healing Smiles of Topeka.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. And from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose mission is to assess practitioner competency to create design solutions that safeguard public health, safety, and welfare. Learn more at CIDQ.org/NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. In a presidential race that's neck and neck, the Washington Post is staying out of it. The newspaper with the motto, "Democracy Dies in Darkness," is not endorsing any candidate for the White House for the first time in a general election since 1988. NPR's David Folkenflik broke the story and joins us now. Hi, David.
Hey, Juana.
So, David, here's the big question. Why? What do we know about why the Post is not endorsing a presidential candidate this year?
Well, I can go first to what the Post's publisher CEO, Will Lewis, has to say. He says they're returning to the Post's roots as an independent paper. That's one of its mottos. It says it's going to back to a time many decades ago when they didn't endorse presidential candidates. They don't want to tell their readers what to think. They want to equip them with what to think. Mm-hmm. And I got to tell you, there is an effort right now to kind of address the concerns of, you know, record low level of trust in the media, and particularly on the conservative side, particularly among people supportive of President Trump. But this is not something that's doing a whole lot of to build up trust and support inside the Post newsroom right now. There's been a series of outcries, really, in the reaction there.
Okay, so you've mentioned the outcries inside the newsroom. I'm curious, just broadly, can you sweep up some of the reaction? What have you been hearing from your sources?
Well, so editor-at-large Robert Kagan has been a columnist there for years. He told me and other news outlets that he had resigned from the editorial board as a result. This was a decision that basically came after the editorial page editor had approved in principle an endorsement of Kamala Harris, Vice President Harris, for the presidency, and that Jeff Bezos, the owner of the Post, basically said, we're not going to be doing that this year. Well, this has also resulted in a lot of tumult. Other people are considering resignations. There's anger inside the newsroom because this is an outlet that has repeatedly, in its reporting, reported on improprieties and, in fact, alleged illegalities by former President Trump while he was in office and his associates, and said he was unfit for service on its separately run editorial page. In addition, I've seen internal correspondence at the Post that shows that already at least 1,600 people have canceled their digital subscriptions. That's far outstrips Wow. their usual pace and suggests real anger on behalf of some of their readership.
David, I got to tell you, some of this sounds a little familiar. When we talked yesterday on the show, we were talking about a similar decision by the owner of the Los Angeles Times. So now in a matter of days, there were two major newspapers, one on each coast, saying they're not weighing in. They don't want to pick between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump in this year's presidential election. Obviously, two different papers, but how should we read these decisions that are at the very top of these massive influential media outlets?
Well, in general, I would say that the kindest way of saying it is that major news organizations have been struggling in the age of social media and in the age of certain kinds of social justice movements to reassert the idea that these conventional big news outlets are independent of any partisan slant, of any ideological taint. And at the same time, you have both of them are owned by billionaires, and right. billionaires with major financial interests. In the case of Patrick Soon-Shiong, the owner of the Los Angeles Times, he's a medical inventor who has a ton of patents and other issues in front of federal regulators. You've got Jeff Bezos, of course, the founder of Amazon. He owns the Washington Post, but he also Amazon has a lot of issues in front of the federal government. It's the postal charges it incurs for its shipping, the question of its cloud computing services for the Department of Defense, and what he does with Blue Origin, his space company with NASA, that's worth billions of dollars, too. As Trump has repeatedly threatened retribution against media outlets that he claims has wronged him, as we talked about yesterday, you're seeing news outlets shy away from punching hard at the president at this moment.
That's NPR Media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thank you.
You bet.
Okay, we turn now to a rare instance of public disagreement from within the U.S. Justice Department. DOJ lawyers sent a letter this week to Attorney General Merrick Garland, and the letter calls out what it describes as the, quote, glaring gap between the department's aggressive approach prosecuting crimes committed by Russia and Hamas versus the department's silence on potential crimes committed by Israel. NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas has obtained the letter and joins us now. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there.
Okay, so before we get into more of what the letter says, what can you tell us about who exactly wrote this letter?
So it's a four-page letter. It was sent out this week. It was first reported by the online outlet Zateo. The letter itself is signed anonymously as your colleagues, but I've confirmed through my own reporting that it was written by three Justice Department attorneys. These are mid-career folks. Two of them work at DOJ headquarters here in Washington. Two of the authors told me that the Israel-Gaza conflict isn't something that's really discussed at work. It's, of course, a politically charged issue. And so the authors considered sending this letter around for signatures, but they have concerns about potential professional blowback for speaking out on this topic. So instead, what they did is write the letter and send it anonymously to the attorney general. Now, it's important to say here that there are around 10,000 attorneys who work at the Justice Department.
Mm-hmm.
This was written by three. So this is a very, very, very small sample.
Yeah.
And it's unclear how widespread the views that are expressed in the letter are at the wider department.
Okay. Well, let's talk more about the letter. What does it say?
Well, the letter points out that Attorney General Merrick Garland has frequently talked about the importance of norms, of treating like cases alike, the idea that the department investigates and prosecutes crimes regardless of political considerations.
Mm-hmm.
That, in fact, was even the theme of a big speech that Garland gave last month to the DOJ workforce. But the letter says that when it comes to potential crimes by Israel, the department under Garland's leadership isn't living up to that. It says that despite credible evidence that Israeli forces have violated law, the department hasn't taken any public steps to hold perpetrators to account, even when the victims are U.S. citizens. And it also says that stands in stark contrast to the Justice Department's very public, very aggressive approach to possible Russian war crimes in Ukraine and Hamas's crimes in its October 7th attack on Israel. To be clear, the letter welcomes the department's tough approach on Russia and Hamas. What the letter is criticizing is the corresponding silence and apparent lack of action regarding potential crimes by Israelis.
So interesting. Well, Ryan, you've reported on the department's approach to both the Russia-Ukraine conflict and the Israel-Hamas conflict. What have you found?
Well, what my reporting has shown is this. After Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, the Attorney General publicly condemned what he called Russia's war crimes. He set up a special team at the department to focus on investigating Russian atrocities. And the department has charged four Russian soldiers so far with war crimes in Ukraine.
Okay.
On the conflict in Gaza, Garland has publicly confirmed the department is investigating Hamas's killing of some 40 Americans, as well as the kidnapping of some in the attack on Israel. And the department has brought terrorism charges against six Hamas leaders.
All right. Well, how does that differ from the department's approach to possible crimes by Israeli forces or Israeli civilians?
Well, the Attorney General has said nothing in public about examining possible Israeli war crimes in Gaza. Israel, for its part, says it obeys the laws of war, but many legal experts say some of Israel's actions certainly could amount to war crimes, including under U.S. law. There are also four American citizens who have been killed in the West Bank and Gaza this year. Their families say by Israeli soldiers or civilians. I and my colleagues here at NPR, we've reported on those killings. We've spoken with all four families, and they told us that they've heard nothing from the Justice Department. Garland has said nothing in public about investigating those killings. The department has declined to comment about any of these issues, including the letter today. That silence has helped fuel the questions raised in the letter about whether the department in these particular matters is taking politics into consideration in its decision making.
That is NPR's Ryan Lucas. Thank you so much, Ryan.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Polls are open across the country. Election Day is just over a week away, and swing states are hotly contested. Voters there feel it.
I need to feel comfortable. That is the only strategy at this state.
We take you to Georgia and the bullseye of campaign 2024. That and news from all around the world, Saturday and weekend edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning beginning at 7 o'clock on your KPR station, 7 to 10 a.m. Weekend Edition Saturday with Scott Simon and Kay McIntyre.
Support for KPR comes from the Topeka Zoo, celebrating 90 years of smiles, memories, wildlife conservation, and education. Open daily from 9 to 5. Calendar of events and ticket information is found at topekazoo.org.
We have news headlines coming up next. 67 degrees in Topeka, 68 in Manhattan. It is 5:30.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. There's a new bronze statue on the National Mall, and it's not a founding father.
No, it's a piece of poop meant to take aim at January 6th.
That's what art is supposed to do. Art is supposed to encourage people to think about things, and sometimes it is meant to shock people.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Israel's military says it's reviewing an airstrike it carried out in southern Lebanon today that killed three journalists. NPR's Arzu Rizvani reports from Beirut.
Israel's military said it struck a Hezbollah military structure today in Hasbaya, a town in southern Lebanon that was widely considered to be safe and where many journalists had been staying when they came under attack before dawn. The three journalists worked for broadcasters Al-Manar, which is a network owned and operated by Hezbollah, and Al-Mayadeen, a pro-Iran, pro-Palestinian news channel. They were spending the night at a guest house along with several journalists from other international news organizations, including Sky News Arabia and Al Jazeera. Their cars parked outside the guest house were clearly labeled press. Lebanon's information minister said the attack was deliberate and called the deaths a war crime. Israel's military said proximity to, quote, terrorist infrastructure poses a danger. Arzu Rizvani, NPR News, Beirut.
An E. coli outbreak affecting at least 75 people in the West and Midwest has expanded to more states. As NPR's Ping Wong tells us, people have gotten sick after eating McDonald's Quarter Pounders.
The E. coli bacteria strain in this outbreak can cause severe infections. At least 75 people in 13 states have gotten sick in the past few weeks, most recently on October 10th. Nearly two dozen people have been hospitalized, a few with severe kidney problems, and one person has died. Most of these patients recalled eating a McDonald's Quarter Pounder before they got ill. That's a beef burger topped with onions and pickles. Federal health authorities say the culprit may be the slivered onions or the beef patty. The onions have been recalled by the supplier, and McDonald's has stopped selling Quarter Pounders in several states for now. Consumers who develop symptoms of E. coli infections, like fever, vomiting, and prolonged diarrhea, are advised to seek medical care. Ping Huang, NPR News.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Laura Lorson with your regional headlines. Powerful storms rolled across northeast Kansas and western Missouri last night, knocking out power to as many as 17,000 customers of Evergy. The utility company says 4,000 homes in the Topeka area lost power. Another 500 homes lost power in Jefferson County. The cities of Hayes and Russell are suing nearby Edwards County for attempts to slow down a water transfer project. The cities say a lack of water due to drought and low groundwater available is a threat to their residents. 30 years ago, the cities purchased a ranch in Edwards County to draw groundwater for the municipalities. Since then, the city manager for Hayes, Toby Doherty, says it's been years of regulatory hurdles.
There are people in Edwards County that don't like seeing that water leave their area. Well, that water leaves their area every day in corn and cattle and hogs and dairies.
An attorney for Edwards County says he's still reviewing the lawsuit. Dr. Roy Menninger, the grandson of the man who found the Menninger Clinic, has died at the age of 97. He's the former CEO of the Menninger Foundation and served as chair of the foundation's board of trustees until 2003, which is when the Menninger Clinic moved to Baylor. Along with his wife, Bev, Menninger served as co-chair of the KPR advisory board for many years. The family is suggesting memorial donations to Doctors Without Borders in lieu of flowers. The 16th-ranked Kansas State Wildcats are still in the running for a Big 12 football championship, but they're hoping to avoid a stumble at 7 o'clock tomorrow night in Manhattan against the Kansas Jayhawks. Greg Eklund filed this preview.
Only BYU and Iowa State remain unbeaten in the Big 12, both with 4-0 conference records and 7-0 overall. But the Wildcats are tied with three other teams with 3-1 conference records. The Wildcats have beaten KU 15 straight times. But Wildcats coach Chris Kleiman says he had no plans to bring up the topic.
The last few years have been really competitive games, and we've found a way. Last year we were down 11 in the second half and found a way.
KU enters the game with an overall record of 2-5 and won its first conference game last weekend against Houston. I'm Greg Eklund.
And a high-profile charity exhibition basketball game is getting underway tonight between the top-ranked Kansas Jayhawks and the Arkansas Razorbacks. The Jayhawks, ranked number one this preseason, will play before a sold-out crowd in Fayetteville at 8 o'clock tonight. Mostly clear skies tonight for northeast and east central Kansas with a low in the mid-30s. Tomorrow, sunshine with a high in the mid-60s. You're listening to KPR. It's 5:35.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The British singer-songwriter Laura Marling signed her first record deal when she was 16 years old. And she knew even then that she wanted to approach the music industry on her terms. Here's what she told a guest host of NPR's Morning Edition way back in 2008.
What's that meeting like where you tell Virgin Records, actually, no, I'm not going to have my photo on the album jacket?
If they ever tried to make me do anything like that, I would down tools.
Is that a British expression? I'm not familiar with it.
Down tools, stop working. Huh. I'd put the guitar down. Music, the music industry is whatever you want it to be. If you want to be mega famous, you're going to have to do things that people tell you. Until you get mega famous, and then you can tell everybody what to do.
Well, now Laura Marling is an established artist who has won a raft of awards, and she has just released her eighth album, Patterns in Repeat. Laura Marling, it is good to talk to you again some 16 years after our last chat.
Wow, I can't believe that. Thank you for having me again.
It's really nice to have you back. You had such a clear vision, even as a teenager, of how you wanted to relate to the music industry, how you wanted to shape your career. How has that vision evolved as you have grown into the established adult artist you are today?
Well, I think it's much the same. I mean, I was surprised to hear myself say that. I don't remember obviously saying that, but I still very much live by that sort of philosophy. And I never have changed since then, it sounds like. I've always just...
I love exactly that you're surprised by that, that it's not like a slogan that is hung on your wall through every record and every interview you've ever done, that like this is your true north.
No, it's not. I mean, I think it's part of my obstinate nature. I think, you know, like a contrarian nature, maybe.
Well, on this latest album, Patterns in Repeat, your new role as a parent figures prominently. At the very top, one of the first sounds we hear is your baby leading into the song Child of Mine.
You and your dad are dancing in the kitchen. Life is slowing down, but it's still pushing.
Can you paint a picture for us of the scene that you are giving us access to here?
So I recorded this album when my daughter was 4 months old, which in retrospect was very smart, because after they can start walking, you really are limited in what you can do. But before that, you know, they sort of sleep or sit on the floor, or, you know. So basically I turned my living room into a recording studio and had her in the room for the entire recording process and just stole moments where I could to record. So there's a lot of sort of incidental homely noise on the album that became quite an important sort of character.
And in this first song especially, I think there are lyrics that feel universal to the experience of being a parent and very elemental.
Last night in your sleep you started crying. I can't protect you there though I keep trying.
That was the first song I wrote after she was born, which I hadn't been expecting to have any interest in writing. I'd like very much prepared for not having any interest in writing for years. But of course, what I didn't understand or foresee is that the experience of becoming a parent really cracks you open to a new level of truly terrifying love.
Your father wrote one of the songs on this album, right?
Yes, he did. He there's a song on the album called Looking Back.
Today with age, my body is bent, and against my will, I must relent.
My father was a songwriter in the 70s, so I knew it. I'd always thought it was a really good song, and then he played it just sort of when he was here visiting after my daughter was born. And it just, like, it floored me, the new relevance that it had to the album that I was putting together. Because it's written from the perspective of an old man looking back over his life and wondering whether his love was well spent.
How did he react when he heard your version of it for the first time?
He actually hasn't.
What?
He hasn't heard it yet. Yeah, he'll hear it when the album comes out. I mean,
no.
I suppose it might, yeah.
Why are you keeping it from him?
I don't know. Again, something to be investigated, some weird sort of crooked
part. Are you going to, like, sit him down and, you know, close the window shades and turn the lights low and play it? Or are you just going to let him download the album on his streaming platform and listen to it whenever he does?
I think probably the latter. Yeah, I think I'm trying to avoid.
I shouldn't judge, but that seems so odd to me.
Welcome to my universe. But, you know, yeah, it's a sort of too embarrassing to confront him with it face to face.
What do you think that means to him, to have that song he wrote on this album?
He's a bit like me. He's sort of embarrassed by too much attention at once. But I think it will mean, I don't know. You love to know what your parents actually feel and think. They're kind of a mystery to me, in the best way.
One could ask.
Yes, but that would be too straightforward. I can cope with that.
You wrote the title track of this album, Patterns and Repeat, when you, your partner, and your baby were in Paris for a funeral, and it was the first time you had ever taken your daughter to a hotel, so people can imagine all of the chaos that that entails.
Yeah.
And there's this line.
I want you to know that I gave it up willingly.
I want you to know that I gave it up willingly.
Nothing real was lost in the bringing of you to me.
Nothing real was lost in the bringing of you to me. Will you tell us about what that means to you? And whether it's true?
Yeah, oh, it's certainly true. The funeral that we were attending was an extraordinary example of what it is to give everything to your children. You know, earlier I was saying, wouldn't it be great to understand the desires and inner workings of your parents? And in a way, it's part of the process that you don't know that, because it's for your benefit that their passions and desires are subjugated in your honor. And there's something profoundly healing about understanding that as you become a parent, and also something to be incredibly proud of.
Do you think about your daughter someday using your songs, these lyrics, this album and others, to understand you in a way that you talk about wanting to or wishing you could understand your own parents?
Maybe. Like, a big part of my early life was finding it very difficult to express myself, you know, straightforwardly. And there may have been suggestions of that still being a problem in my life in this very interview, but... In some ways, that is a problem. But where I have never struggled to say something in terms of what I want to get across is in songwriting. So I hope it serves as that, if not just for my daughter, for people in general.
Well, Laura Marling, it has been such a pleasure talking to you again after all of these years. Thank you for the conversation.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed speaking with you again.
Her new album is Patterns in Repeat.
And as those years go by, they'll look upon you kindly.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
New York versus Los Angeles, Yankees versus Dodgers, Aaron Judge versus Shohei Ohtani. The World Series begins tonight, and it is the most hyped World Series in a generation. And here to hype me is NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan. Hey, Becky.
Elsa.
Okay, this is not going to be impartial journalism right now because, of course, I am going to be rooting for the LA Dodgers, my home team. LA is going nuts this week. Help us understand.
Yes. Yeah,
Becky,
I mean,
this World Series is such a big deal.
Totally. And it is. It's a juggernaut of a matchup. This is like a Goliath versus Goliath situation. It's actually been sort of rare in baseball to have the two best teams face off in the World Series lately. But we're undeniably getting that this year, no matter what way you look at it. So these two teams had the best records in their respective leagues. They had the two best players, the likely MVPs, and Judge and Ohtani, as you mentioned, and certainly just two of baseball's, you know, like just most storied franchises. A rivalry that dates back like 100 years.
Yeah, when the Dodgers were still in New York, right? The Brooklyn Dodgers.
Exactly, yeah. So this was like a crosstown rivalry. You had players like Joe DiMaggio, Jackie Robinson, Sandy Koufax, Mickey Mantle. I mean, like,
wow,
it's nuts. So they, the Dodgers and the Yankees had met 11 times in the World Series. This will be the 12th. That's a record. And then somehow, despite the pedigrees, we actually haven't seen the Yankees win a title since 2009. And then the Dodgers, their only title since the 80s was the 2020 season, which was shortened by the pandemic and sort of a seen in the baseball world as having a little bit of an asterisk.
Okay, so according to you, this is going to be hugely exciting, but do all baseball fans agree?
Oh, well, I mean, there's always going to be the haters. And so maybe for you, I can put like a little hater hat on, play
pretend. Let me see that hat.
Say you grew up with a small market team like the Kansas City Royals. My team has been to the playoffs only 3 times in my entire life. So imagine those long-suffering Los Angeles Dodgers fans, 12 postseason appearances in a row. Three-year-olds in Los Angeles also have had their team in the playoffs as many times as I have. So then the Yankees, no title since 2009. I hope that they are crying themselves to sleep on a pile of those 27 World Series trophies they have. So these are two of the richest payrolls in baseball, according to SpotTrack, which is this like service that tracks sports financials. Uh-huh. The Yankees and the Dodgers rosters this year combined to cost more than the cheapest 6 entire teams in baseball. So of course they can afford great players. So now they're in the World Series. That's the hater perspective. Personally, I'm jazzed.
Okay, but there must be something even a hater can enjoy
about
all this, right?
You're going to be watching the two best players in baseball today. Shohei Ohtani came to the U.S. for the 2018 season. He's amazing both at pitching and batting. This is his first postseason appearance. This season, he's been recovering from surgery to his pitching elbow, so he's only been batting, but still his season has been unbelievable. He became the first player ever to hit more than 50 home runs and steal more than 50 bases in the same regular season, and somehow has been even more impressive in the postseason.
That's my man. Okay, what about the Yankees star?
Yeah. Well, so that's Aaron Judge. This season, he posted just like a history book level batting season, 58 home runs in the regular season. He hasn't been quite as dominant in the postseason yet. People are hoping that he'll break out now that he's here, but he is almost certainly going to win the American League MVP, as Ohtani will in the National League. And the fact that these two guys are household names is just like a real change of pace for baseball, which has struggled to market its stars in the past. So it is like a dream for league officials and for fans to have them meet on the sport's biggest stage. I think this World Series, Yankees, Dodgers, Ohtani versus Judge, is going to show us the absolute ceiling for Major League Baseball right now.
Woohoo! That is NPR's Becky Sullivan. Thank you, Becky.
You're welcome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Morning Edition from NPR News brings you reporting from around the world.
NPR's Carrie Khan is covering all this from the Venezuelan city of Caracas.
And we also realize there's plenty to learn at home, literally.
Here's my compost bin in the freezer. We've got some tomato bits, and now we're adding 2 tea bags.
Listen for the latest headlines plus useful life hacks every weekday on Morning Edition.
Join us Monday through Friday, 5 to 9 a.m. on your KPR stations for Morning Edition. From the University of Kansas, this is Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 90.3 FM in Chanute, always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from Maselli's, presenting Cabaret Brunch, featuring Mary Baker and friends on October 27th. Brunch buffet at 10 a.m. Show starts at 11. Information and tickets available at masellisonline.com.
Stay with us. Coming up in our next half hour in Pittsburgh, taxes are one reason a small business owner says he's voting for Vice President Kamala Harris.
She says she's willing to tax the upper class, and I believe that that is necessary. There needs to be a real tax on people who are making all this money, and then everyone else is kind of hurting.
How the economy and inflation are affecting choices at the ballot box, we'll talk about it coming up on KPR.
Support for KPR comes from Liberty Hall Video in downtown Lawrence, with more than 11,000 titles on DVD and Blu-ray available to rent, from classics to cult. Open daily from 1 to 9 p.m. A browsable inventory is online at libertyhall.net.
Quick reminder, hey, we've got a party at the LPL tonight, 7 p.m. You can either join us via the radio or go on down to the Lawrence Public Library for a free concert, part of KPR's Live Day. It's 66 degrees
from
in
NPR
Lawrence.
News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Growing up, Olivia Kwan's mom, Basha, used to take her out into the cul-de-sac to play football. Two-hand touch football. It felt normal to Kwan. She'd grown up hearing her mom's stories of playing professional football with the Houston Hurricanes.
And it wasn't until quite a bit later in life when I started to really put the pieces together that not everyone's mom played football. In fact, very few people's moms played football.
Not only that, Kwan says, kids at school didn't believe her that her mom played football. They, like a lot of people, believed pro football was just for men.
That, you know, was the early onset of the frustration about the perception of women in football for me.
Now, Olivia Kwan has turned that childhood frustration into action. A documentary called The Hurricanes, all about the Houston Hurricanes and the National Women's Football League of the 1970s.
Yeah, the league was started by a fella named Sid Friedman, and he kind of thought that the whole thing would be a bit of a spectacle, kind of like a circus act, maybe similar to the Harlem Globetrotters. And some tension formed between Sid and his vision and the women who showed up to play. They wanted to play real football, real tackle football, and he wanted something different. So the players quickly spun away from Sid Friedman, and eventually the actual NWFL was formed in 1974. 2 years after that was pretty much the height of the NWFL, and at that point it was about 14 teams strong, and they were clusters of teams in the Ohio area, which included Pennsylvania and Michigan, and there was a cluster in California, and then there was at last the cluster in the South, which included Texas and Oklahoma.
I have to say, I am a person that absolutely loves football, and I clock more hours than I will admit right now watching NFL games on Sundays, and even given all of that, this part of football history is one that I didn't know a whole lot about myself, even given the current spotlight that there is on women's sports. So I wonder for you, why do you think it is that the National Women's Football League's history isn't well known?
Well, don't worry, you're not alone. It comes down to the fact that these women were not accepted in the 1970s. It was really difficult to get media attention. It was really difficult to get butts in the seats. They did have a bit more attention on them in smaller municipalities such as Tulsa, Oklahoma City, but in a big city like Houston, the Houston Hurricanes were really struggling to get any attention when they were competing with the Houston Oilers or other professional men's sports.
I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about the story of the Hurricanes. In your documentary, even despite that early rocky start, the Hurricanes, they kept going, the league keeps going, and the team and its players, they get better despite a really stunning lack of resources. Throughout the course of the documentary, we get to hear some of the incredible personal stories that these players told you about the team, what it meant to play. I wonder, is there one that sticks out in your memory that you could share with us?
Yeah. My mom has always really valued her football playing experience. But when I started talking to the other players of the Houston Hurricanes, it was very clear that to some of them, this was one of the most impactful experiences of their entire life. There was one woman who told me that this was where she found real love and had a sistership with her teammates that cannot be found anywhere else in her life.
I would look forward to go to practice. I would look forward to go play that game. I would look forward to go to that club after that game. I would look forward to be with my sisters.
There's definitely a few women who talked about how they really needed to push themselves physically and how that created this determination within them that they carried all the way through their life today.
It was special just having a group of women that wanted to play football and were willing to go out there and hit and get dirty and sweat and not to be afraid to say they were strong.
And that's really one of the things that I think is the most powerful message about the women's sports movement in general. If we empower girls and women to participate in sports, it opens them up to leadership positions that they may not have been able to pursue otherwise. It's something that everyone can gain from.
Olivia, this is a story about sports, but it's also a family story. You excavated all of these memories and dug into all of this history that forms the documentary with your mom, who, of course, had the firsthand experience. I wonder, did going through the years-long process of putting together this documentary, did it all help you come to know your mother and her story differently?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that was really nice about doing this project is that in the beginning, it was just me and her working on it together. It really helped transform our relationship into a place where it was less mother and child and a little bit more eye to eye. As far as perception is concerned, I always have remembered her as being a very strong woman. And this has, if anything, only reinforced that.
We've been speaking with Olivia Kwan, director of The Hurricanes. The film opens in Houston first, then across the country throughout the fall. Olivia, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
A new statue erected on the National Mall is causing quite a stir. The statue depicts a bronze swirled poop on top of a recreation of Nancy Pelosi's desk. And below it is a plaque that reads in part, "This memorial honors the brave men and women who broke into the United States Capitol on January 6, 2021 to loot, urinate, and defecate throughout those hallowed halls in order to overturn an election." NPR's Mia Venkat went out to the statue today to hear what people had to say about it.
Workers are mowing the lawn as I walk up to the group of people gathered around the statue taking photos and selfies with it. There's someone in a Harris Walls camo hat. Some people stop by while on a run. Several others are in suits. People bend down to read the plaque.
My reaction when I found out about it was obviously that it was funny.
Kristen Hartke lives in New York now, but lived in D.C. at the time of the insurrection, just a couple blocks from the Capitol. She's also a trained artist, and she hopes the meaning of the statue doesn't get misinterpreted.
I think I would interpret the message as being pretty facetious, and clearly that visual that they have with this piece of art is showcasing that.
Well, at first, I was just told it was a poo statue, but actually after reading what it's about, I think it takes us back to the gravity of that day, and it takes us back to who do we want to be as a nation.
Anu Mandapati is from Austin, Texas, in town visiting a friend who took her to see the statue, whereas Jeff Parcells Johnson lives in Alexandria, Virginia. He biked over to see if the statue was actually real.
I think it's just a great juxtaposition to what Trump thinks this was, and it's funny. It's worthwhile to laugh at that sometimes.
According to the permit for the anonymous artwork, approved by the National Park Service, it will be on display until October 30th. We reached out to the person who requested the permit and have not yet heard back. And as I left the mall, massive sprinklers start up, soaking a few onlookers trying to get the perfect shot of the bronze poop. Mia Venkat, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at amazonbusiness.com. From Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
Jewel Say Sloan in for Peter Sagal. On this week's Wait Wait, canceling plans is easier than ever when we spend time with Sue Bird and Megan Rapinoe. Join us for the news quiz from NPR.
You will hear Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock on your KPR1 stations. We're live. We're local. We are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3, K210CR Atchison 89.9, K258BT Manhattan 99.5, and at kansaspublicradio.org. It's 6 o'clock.
You have to choose in this race between someone who has been faithful to the Constitution, who will be faithful, and Donald Trump.
Former Congresswoman Liz Cheney and other Republicans urge members of their party to vote for Vice President Harris.
For Friday, October 25th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Our series, We the Voters, continues in North Carolina, which has more rural voters than any other swing state.
There's a lot of people want to stay out the way. They see the Trump signs. They see what's going on in school board, city council. They're just like, I'm going to stay out of it.
Also, the president of the union that represents WNBA players on why they deserve higher wages and more benefits after a historic season.
What the public is feeling and seeing is something that we've always known. And this new era is just us realizing that people see us for what we are.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Campaigning in Texas today, Vice President Kamala Harris took aim at her rival Donald Trump for comments the Republican presidential candidate made in Arizona. During an event there last night, Trump referring to the U.S. as, quote, a garbage can for the world, claiming other countries send criminals here. Harris called it just another example of Trump belittling the country.
This is someone who is a former president of the United States who has a bully pulpit. And this is how he uses it, to tell the rest of the world that somehow the United States of America is trash.
Trump has repeatedly said if elected, he'll carry out mass deportations that will break records. He kicked off his remarks by slamming a judge ordering Virginia to restore voters who were purged from the state's voter rolls close to Election Day. Former President Trump made campaign stops in Texas today as well. Trump held a small event in Austin while in town to record an interview for Joe Rogan's podcast. NPR's Ashley Lopez has more.
Joe Rogan has the most listened to podcast in the country, and it's particularly popular with young men, which is a demographic Trump continues to court heavily even as he tries to broaden his base of support. While in Austin, the Trump campaign also held a small event focused on immigration. Besides blaming migrants for a series of crimes, he criticized his opponent, who was also campaigning in the state.
Today, Kamala is here in Texas to rub shoulders with woke celebrities. Isn't that exciting? But she's not going to meet with any of the victims of migrant crime.
Harris is capping her day in Texas with a big event in Houston featuring Beyonce. Ashley Lopez, NPR News.
The Washington Post owner Jeff Bezos has decided the paper will not endorse anyone in this year's presidential race, the first time since 1988. NPR's David Folkenflik broke the story and reports that the head of the paper's editorial page has already approved backing Vice President Kamala Harris.
The Washington Post reporters have uncovered wrongdoing by former President Donald Trump and his associates while in office. The editorial page, which operates separately, has repeatedly characterized Trump as being unfit for that office. Publisher Will Lewis told readers the paper sought to return to its roots of decades ago when it did not endorse presidential candidates. The paper's editorial writers were outraged. Editor-at-large Robert Kagan has resigned. It's the prerogative of newspaper owners to make such decisions, and it is common that they do so. In this case, an editorial endorsing Harris was already in the works. The move follows a similar decision by Los Angeles Times owner Patrick Soon-Shiong. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
The former longtime CEO of Abercrombie & Fitch has pleaded not guilty to federal sex trafficking and interstate prostitution charges. Michael Jeffries declined to comment today after entering the plea in federal court in New York. He's free on $10 million bond. On Wall Street, stocks closed lower. The Dow was down 259 points. You're listening to NPR. Three astronauts and a cosmonaut who were aboard the International Space Station for almost 8 months are back on Earth. A SpaceX capsule carrying the crew parachuting into the Gulf of Mexico just off the Florida coast before dawn today. Three Americans and one Russian should have returned from the ISS 2 months ago, but were delayed by problems with Boeing's Starliner capsule. Shortly after splashdown, NASA says one astronaut had a medical issue, but the agency says that person is now in stable condition and hospitalized as a precautionary measure. Wildfires have destroyed large parts of Brazil's Amazon rainforest this year. The region is in the second year of a record-breaking drought. NPR's Kerry Kahn reports satellite analysis of fires shows the number of acres destroyed by blazes at the highest level in decades.
According to satellite data obtained by the Associated Press, fires devastated an area of the Amazon the size of Switzerland so far this year. That's an increase of more than 800% over the same period last year. A thick smoky haze has covered multiple states in the Amazon, producing some of the worst air quality in the world. Scientists attribute the fire's widespread destruction to the current drought in the Amazon, now in its second year, which is tied to global warming. However, officials in Brazil say criminals are also to blame as they take advantage of the record dry conditions and set fires to clear land for illegal uses. Federal police say they're working to expand efforts to combat such environmental crimes. Kerry Kahn, NPR News, Rio de Janeiro.
Crude oil futures prices after bouncing around a bit closed higher. Oil up more than 2.25% to $71.78 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie, Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is only in theaters this Thursday.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from the Midwest Trust Center, presenting Mariachi Arencia de Mexico on October 26th. The new generation of mariachi takes the stage for a night of Mexican music. More at jccc.edu/mtc.
63 degrees in Lawrence, 65 in Manhattan, 62 in Atchison. It is 6:06.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Vice President Kamala Harris.